There we go. A little technical glitch there to start the night off. New studio, new buttons to push, new levers, new stuff to get used to. But we will make do. Welcome back. Welcome to the program. Tonight on the big program, we'll be talking about the Thanksgiving tomorrow. Looking forward to the big day of family fun, and just a time for at least most of us to sit, reflect, relax, and enjoy a day of family and rest. I look at this and I'm frustrated. I'm angry. I think most people that I talk to get it, that we're seeing the destruction of the Thanksgiving holiday, this war on Thanksgiving, which I wish my conservative friends would, I wish they would come out, say, hey, you know, we're pro-business, but this is ridiculous. Anyway, tonight on the program, talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act. Black Friday's coming up, and so how does all that stuff get on the shelves? How do we get the stuff from China all the way over to the shelves? We'll talk about that. Also, your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. The Pope under attack. I don't know if you saw the news report. I don't listen to Limbaugh, but I guess it went after the Pope pretty handily. How dare he? How dare he question the laissez-faire free neoliberal markets? How dare he? The free market's the best thing in the history of civilization, the history of sliced bread. How dare the Pope attack people with money and people who are successful? How dare the Pope? And I find it interesting because, you know, finally something coming out of the Pope's mouth that I agree with. We should take, and maybe we should have rule 11. Maybe it's like the Monty Python things, where we have 15 cracked, 10 commandments. Maybe those last five were the ones that said, you know, thou shall not have an economy that screws the workers. Thou shall not have an economy that benefits only a handful. Maybe we missed those. And I find it interesting that the Pope, you know, says, look, we need to have politicians who are going to guarantee dignified work, going to guarantee education, going to guarantee health care for all citizens, equal across all lines. And this is the Pope saying this. This isn't, you know, some lefty radical. Although, you're going to start seeing that label attached to him. And I find it interesting that, you know, you look at this and they've taken what should be a really just, I don't care if you're religious or spiritual or what, but should be a moment of reflection, a moment to stop and be grateful, be thankful, and of you know, what we have and where we are and who, our health and our family. And, you know, I think my wife and I had this conversation last night, you know, of the things that we are grateful for and the things that we are thankful for. And, you know, both of us, you know, our health, our children, our family, you know, the things that we've been blessed with, the things that we've been able to attain in our working lives and our relationship and all of these things. And, you know, my wife and I grew up in two very different worlds. And, you know, in her world where she grew up was, you know, the very typical Norman Rockwell kind of country type. Grew up on a ranch in Southern California, and, you know, just idyllic. You know, everything about it sounded, wow, I wish I could have just experienced that on one day. And, you know, she listens to some of the stories that I tell from my childhood. And as I told her last night, the one thing that I'm most grateful for, the one thing that I'm most thankful for, is that I have yet to have to look into my kids' eyes and know that they're going to go to bed hungry. I have yet to have to look into my kids' eyes and know that they're not going to have a place to rest their head. And I think that's really something that I guess I'm proud of, because I never really thought that I would be able to do some of the things I've been able to do. I never really thought that I would be able to provide for my children. I never even thought I was going to have children, to be honest with you, because I said if I couldn't afford them, there's just no way I was ever going to put them through the misery and the nightmares that I went through. And I guess that's kind of why I you know, my wife kind of accuses me of spoiling them a little bit. Because, you know, I guess it's that mentality, that time, that, and I, you know, and it's just one of the things that, you know, popped into my head. We had gone to Boscoff's, and Boscoff's is one of the few places around here that has like a candy counter where they've got, you know, this counter full of stuff. And, you know, one of the very few happy, really joyous moments I remember as a kid is, you know, my mother used to take me to the Sears, in Cleveland, and they had this big candy counter. I was allowed to pick out one thing. It was just this amazing memory of, you know, just being a kid and being overwhelmed. And I take the kids through that. All whenever we see one, we have to stop. And my wife's like, "Oh, you're spoiling the heck out of them." I'm going, "Yeah, but you know what? I'm grateful and thankful that I can do that. And I know that there are people in our society right now. There are people who are listening to this program right now who unfortunately haven't had that, don't have that." And when the Pope talks about the idolatry of money, and when he talks about the kind of greed and the kind of this economic system that we've allowed to spring up around us, that we've allowed to be forced upon us, it angers and frustrates me because I worry about those kids. I worry that they're not going to have the opportunities that I had throughout my life, the opportunities to work hard, to claw my way out of poverty, and to be able to move forward. And you go, "Well, that's your American dream. You pulled yourself up by your bootstraps." Not so fast. And I would like to be one of those people who goes, "Yeah, you know, I did it all by myself, and I whittled bootstraps out of grass and mud, and did it all myself, and didn't need any help from anyone." Well, the reality is society. Good, caring, decent, honest people. Those folks who, all along the way, lent a helping hand. And what really frustrates and angers me is that it seems, folks, that we're moving to more of an isolated, hooray for me, screw everyone else, kind of mentality. "Well, I did it. They should have to do it too, and they should have to suffer." And this is why I'm happy to hear what the Pope has to say. I didn't know how I was going to feel about this Pope. I wasn't thrilled with the last one. But I got to be honest, I give the guy credit for stepping aside. So when I look at what the Pope had to say about this idolatry of money, and I can't help but think about the CEOs and the people who sit in these corporate offices who make these decisions that say, "Well, we're going to keep, instead of just ruining Black Friday, we're going to ruin that one day." And as I've been saying all week, there's really just a couple of days left that really is all about the family. There's just a couple of days. I mean, Christmas being one of them, that's one of the last days. Thanksgiving, I always thought that would be they ruined it when they started going to midnight, because then all the workers got to go to bed early so they can get there at midnight. They ruined that. But, you know, symbolically, you could say, "Well, that's still Friday. It's the next day, you know, whatever." Now they're saying, "Well, we're gonna open up at 9 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night." You got the Kmart saying, "We're gonna be open at 6 o'clock in the morning on Thursday." And you look at these big name retailers who are making billions of dollars. And I ask, isn't it possible just for one day? It's not like you're gonna lose the sale. It's not like the people aren't gonna come through your door. They are. And I hope people will remember. Because I've been saying, look, there is absolutely a war on Thanksgiving. And it's more than just a war on Thanksgiving. It is a war on family. It is a war on each and every family in this country. And you go, "Well, they're just giving us opportunity to go buy stuff." Yeah. What they're actually doing is they're taking that one day. Or as a society, we said, you know, it's important for us to be with our family. It's important to be together. And now they're tearing that apart. And you know the big boxers. You know the Walmarts, the Targets, the Kmarts, the Macy's, the Kohl's. Throw in their Office Max and Best Buy and Staples. Toys R Us, can't forget them. And if Kmart's doing it, you know Sears has got to do it. JCPenney's, they're struggling, so you know they got to do it. And, oh, hey, you know, we're going to get some kids out because they don't want to be around the family anyway. So Old Navy and Banana Republic and Gap, all of them, oh, yeah, we're gonna jump right on. H.H. Gregg or H.R. Gregg or whatever, the electronics store that sprung up after Circuit City, that they're in on it. And I would say, look, in my view, those would be the places I would say, you know what, I'm going to choose not to spend my money there. I would choose to say, you know what, certainly not on Thursday. But not on Friday either. And maybe take a look at some of the stores that, you know, that are going to let their workers stay home. Like Costco. I've been a fan of Costco for a while, and I know there are some who say, well, you know, they're just another one of those big corporations. Yeah, well, they're one of the people who are saying, you know, stay home with your families. Radio Shack, PC Richards, you need electronics, PC Richards. REI company. There's another one. Patagonia. Okay, there's a couple of places where we can go to say, you know what? These are folks who seem to, at least on the surface, care about family values. Ross and Marshalls, TJ Maxx, Nordstrom's, Burlington Coat Factory. Maybe go there on Black Friday instead. Or on Small Business Saturday or Sadistic Sunday or you know, what were the other ones? Cyber Monday. And of course, don't forget Giving Tuesday. Make sure you give to your favorite charity on Tuesday and, you know, Hungover Wednesday. And because we're moving on tomorrow, Thankless Thursday. And how many workers are going to end up having to go to work? How many people are going to be torn from their families? Now, the good thing, and this is what gives me some hope, what gives me some hope is there are workers who are going to be taking to the streets tomorrow. I know in Chicago, for instance, today you saw workers at the Whole Foods stores in Chicago taking to the streets, saying, you know, they're not going to come to work on Thanksgiving. You're seeing all across the country at Walmarts and these retailers, people going out and saying, you know, no more. And I understand in Harrisburg there's going to be one, which I'm going to be out on probably on Friday. But there's part of me that says, you know, it comes down to each and every one of us. Just because they dangle the carrot out in front of us, just because they, oh, we got the sale, doesn't mean we have to go running towards it. And I know times are tough. I do. I know we're working harder and longer for less. I know. And it's enticing. Oh, I can get a Chinese-made big screen TV that'll last about 6 months for $50 less. And, you know, they've got one, and I might get that one. It's kind of like the lottery. So I wonder, how many people are planning to go out on Thursday? Are you planning to be one of the folks who walks away from the family just so you can maybe get a deal? Maybe, as I've heard, not many deals going to be had on Thursday, but maybe you'll get something. And are you planning on going out on Friday? I personally am not, but I'm curious. Curious if you are. I'd be interested. 1-888-520-RICK. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about how do those products get to the shelf? What are the conditions under which those workers have to work to get them there? Quick break. Right back. We want the world and we're wanting it. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the airwaves.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Some Whole Foods workers in Chicago are staging a one-day strike today to demand a fair system of scheduling that will allow them to enjoy Thanksgiving like millions of other Americans. They're being joined by the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, our Walmart, and other community allies. Whole Foods worker Matthew Camp says that retail workers are facing what he says is a disturbing trend of having to work through Thanksgiving and other holidays that used to be sacred time off to spend with family. Camp says this is why Whole Foods workers in Chicago are striking today.
The day before Thanksgiving, which of course is an incredibly busy day for a grocery store, essentially to make these two points. One, that this tendency among large retailers is very disturbing, you know, that we feel everyone's entitled to this holiday. And secondly, that we include ourselves in that first proposal, that we also, having worked so hard for the holiday, are entitled to for time to travel, to see our friends, to see our families.
This strike for better schedules and holidays off is within the context of a larger struggle at Whole Foods.
We're organizing with the Workers' Organizing Committee in the Fight for 15 campaign for better working conditions, a better attendance policy. We don't have sick days at Whole Foods, and for better wages as well. That being said, this particular action, the day before Thanksgiving, is really something of our own design. We were inspired, as Whole Foods workers, we were inspired by the Our Walmart Black Friday strikes that have been going on for the past couple of years.
Supporters of comprehensive immigration reform are working to intensify political pressure on Republican U.S. House Speaker John Boehner to act on immigration reform. Since November 12th, SEIU's Eliseo Medina, Dreamer and Mi Familia Vota's Christian Avia, and Dae Jung Yoon have been fasting in a Fast for Families tent on Washington's National Mall. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez has been fasting for 40 days. They vow to continue their fast until they can no longer physically sustain it. A major new nationwide effort by civil rights, faith, and immigration reform groups is being launched to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. Pope Francis on Tuesday said capitalism is a new tyranny. He called on world leaders to act to address poverty and growing inequality. In an 84-page document, the Pope said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume free market economic growth will bring greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Pope Francis said that's never been confirmed by the facts, and meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. He said under this capitalist tyranny, the powerful feed on the powerless. Thanks to hundreds of listeners and some labor unions who responded to our emergency funding appeal, Workers Independent News is still here in Madison, Wisconsin, putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To make sure we stay here, become a solidarity sustainer by donating now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick. @TheRickSmithShow.com. So tomorrow, Thankless Thursday, you got to wonder how many people are going to be out there shopping on Black Thursday leading into Black Friday. And you got to wonder, you know, how did all this stuff get on the shelves? You know, someone who's driven a truck for years, you got to wonder how exactly did it all get there. Maybe we need to have the class that tells us how that happens. And here to talk a little bit about it and about his piece over at The Nation, I've got Gabriel Thompson. He's a staff writer over there at The Nation. Gabriel, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be here.
You know, I look at, you know, as somebody who drove a truck for 20 years for a living, I know the hard work, the dedication, and all the stuff that goes into getting product to the shelf so that Black Friday can happen. But, you know, a lot of folks don't, which is why when I saw your article, I said, you know, this is somebody we should be talking to. So walk me a little bit through what you found.
Yeah, so I went to an area in Southern California called the Inland Empire, which is about an hour east of L.A. And over the last 10 years or so, there's been this incredible boom in warehousing and the logistics industry. What's been driving that boom is that more than 40% of U.S. imports come in through L.A. and Long Beach port. And all those goods coming from Asia need to be stored somewhere and then restocked and sent out to either, you know, people that order online or to distribution centers or straight to your big box retailers. And there's not very much space in L.A. right now to build these massive warehouses.
Right.
So what's been happening, the region that I was in and where I got a temp job at a warehouse, it's just you drive through mile after mile of these giant cement slabs and all windowless and gray. And there's this, you know, relatively brand new, huge workforce of a warehouse.
Yeah, and we've got them here. I mean, you see these huge, massive warehouses where you think, wow, there's got to be a lot of people working there. And you find out in these several hundred thousand square foot warehouses, you've got a handful of people who are loading the trucks and doing the work. It's interesting on a certain level.
Yeah, and, you know, there's also a sort of it fits into the big story of what's been happening to workers. In the Inland Empire, talking about Riverside, San Bernardino, these were areas that were just crushed by the recession. And so they had incredibly high foreclosure rates, high poverty rates, lost something like 70,000 construction jobs since the recession and the housing bust. So those jobs and manufacturing in the area sort of gone. And the new jobs are these warehouse jobs. And there are folks that say, well, you know, fulfillment is a new manufacturing. Fulfillment meaning the folks that are stocking and loading all the orders that people place online. But what you find, at least what I found working at the place, was that the job was advertised as a sort of temp to hire, $9 an hour, no benefits.
And you never get hired.
Well, right. I mean, even in the orientation, they're pretty straight up. They say, you know, you're here for the holiday rush, and, you know, of the, you know, 800 temps we'll have by Thanksgiving, you know, maybe 150 to 200 will keep past the holiday season, and maybe a few of those, the top performers, could potentially become hired on full-time as staff at the warehouse, as direct hires, and with that would come an increase in wages and even benefits.
Maybe benefits. Did you actually work for the company, or did you work for one of these third-party logistics companies? Because what I find in these warehouse situations, you don't actually work for Amazon, you don't actually work for, you know, Target or whoever, whoever it is. You work for a third party, you know, ABC Staffing or whatever. This way you don't have the ability to unionize or to even have any claim to a job, so that they're able to have another layer of exploitation. Did you find that in your experience?
Yeah, it's all very confusing. So the temp agency, I was technically an employee of a temp agency placed at a third-party logistics company which does warehousing, moving products primarily for Walmart and Apple. We were all part of this new product launch for the iPad Air, which was going on sale the next day, so we had to rush to get tens of thousands of the products out. So it's all very – there are many layers to it. And even when I went to the temp agency was called one name. The name on the office was another. The signs in the office had a third name.
Your paycheck had another?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, the paycheck had the same one as one of those three, but the logistics company actually had a full time office on site with a temp staffer. So, you know, they did a bustling business, and I worked there. While I was there, you know, I think there was about 30 people in my orientation. Almost the whole time I was there, almost practically everyone I interacted with was a temp. And you can tell because it's a badge. There's a badge that identifies. And the common themes of the workers, you know, a lot of them had bounced around from temp job to temp job and a warehouse job, kind of hoping that they'd be one of the lucky top performers to stay on, but found that not to be the case.
I find that not to be the case just across the whole industry, because the idea is we want you to be hungry and you'll come in and you'll bust your behind. And then when we're done and you're used up, we can get rid of you. You know, it's this temp model where you'll come in, you'll bust your behind for 6 months, and then you'll take your injuries with you and be someone else's problem. What I find interesting about it, I gotta wonder how many people did you see over 30 or over 40? How many folks did you see who were up in age in the warehouse that you worked in? I'm curious.
It's mostly a younger workforce, definitely. And I mean, injuries. Team, even in the orientation, they say people are always getting hurt because they work too fast. But then they follow that up with, and we really need you to work really fast.
Yeah.
So it's just sort of these conflicting sometimes messages. I know when I walked into the big warehouse on the first day, it says days without an accident. And I'd worked at a poultry plant where you could theoretically go hundreds of days without an accident. At least that's what companies claim. But this was 4 days without an accident was assigned. So I think it's the hustle and bustle. Also, there's just no stability. And I don't mean long-term work prospects. I mean day-to-day. Like, you don't know if you're going to work 4 hours, 8 hours, or 12. My shift start at 8 a.m. one day, 4 a.m. the next day, 7 a.m. the day after. And so there's this real sense that, you know, they say jump, you say how high, and you really, it's hard to sort of organize the rest of your life.
Yeah, and the other thing I just popped into my head, any on-call hours? Because I find a lot of these warehouses and a lot of these places, and amazingly, PBS, I guess, just figured out that there's such a thing as on-call employment, where maybe you'll work tomorrow, maybe you won't, but you got to sit by the phone and wait anyway. I'm curious, did you experience any of that?
No, we didn't have that. That's when I interviewed the labor group trying to organize workers out there. It's called the Warehouse Workers United. And they have a number of wage theft cases and workers complaining about showing up to work and being told there wasn't work, or showing up saying there was going to be X number of hours and not being X number of hours and not being paid for the full paycheck issues. But for me, where I was working, it wasn't. What there was instant, no knowledge when you showed up how long you'd be there. And if you have a car, you know, that's a pain. You might not get a lot of money, but a lot of folks actually were in a position where they didn't have enough money for cars. And so there's one woman I remember who we got suddenly dismissed at noon, and the next day I saw her rubbing her feet and sort of complaining and learning that she had walked the 8 miles to her house.
Wow.
Because her ride was scheduled to come later that day, and then they were dismissed. And so it's that sort of environment in which it's very hard to hold together the semblance of a sort of normal life with other responsibilities.
And of course, these warehouses aren't on the bus line. It's not like public transportation is readily available.
No, the warehouse where I was working, and where it's just a full collection, a sort of industrial area, there's really no traffic there except for big rigs, you know, trucks coming in and out,
yeah,
and the occasional employees in the place. So it's really away from anything that any public transit.
And for people who may not know, these are like armed compounds, 10-foot-high fences, barbed wire. Any opportunity to organize these workers, even talk to them, is virtually impossible. Because, you know, in the warehouses, in these situations where I've been, you know, they've got double layers of fences and security guards everywhere and cameras absolutely everywhere. It's like an armed fortress.
Well, I found, even for the employees, when we entered and exited the warehouse, you go through this security checkpoint, much like the airport. And when you go out to prevent theft, I was buzzing the security checkpoint, even because I have a sort of titanium rod in my collarbone from bike accident. It actually doesn't go off at the airport, but it went off there.
Yeah.
And so they wand you down. Then they asked me to take off my shoes and shake out my shoes. And then as I was leaving, they asked me to open my wallet to make sure I didn't have any contraband in my wallet.
So let me ask you.
Yeah.
Did you get paid for that time? Because, you know, for me, you're at their behest. You should be getting paid from the time you come in, time you go out. I've found, and hopefully you'll surprise me and say, yes, you got paid, but I've yet to find anybody who got paid for that time through the checkpoints.
I'm not sure because I haven't actually received my paycheck yet.
Uh-oh.
My work was pretty recent. I do know that, you know, there certainly are many opportunities to sort of shave quarter, you know, 15 minutes here, half hours there in general. And I'll give you an example. When our orientation was at 8:15, and I was told be there early, so I got there at 8. So we get there at 8:15, we have our badges, security badges photographed, we wait for another 15 minutes, we go upstairs. By now it's 8:30, and we've been there at least for 15 minutes, most people a half hour if we got there early. And our sign-in time, we were told to sign in at 8:30. It's not a huge deal. It's 15 minutes. But, it's the representative there said, well, you know, we just wanted you to be here early. And, you know, we said 8:15, but sign in for 8:30. And no one really said anything. I think that's indicative to some extent of the a sort of power arrangement.
Do you think that people have just gotten used to this, that now we understand if you're a low-wage worker, if you're one of these workers, you expect to be exploited on a certain level?
Well, it's a broad thing. I'd say it certainly can feel that way. You know, I was commiserating with some of the other folks in my orientation who were saying, you know, that they felt like it was, they never, and these are folks who worked in warehouses before and worked temp in warehouses before in the area, that never felt so much like they were just so explicitly like, you're going to be here for 2 months and we're talking you out. I would say, though, in speaking to some of the folks that are trying to organize these guys and then one of the worker leaders I interviewed, that the fact that the work is so insecure and that many times the promises of temp to full-time work don't happen, and that retaliation can happen so easily. You know, it's very easy to just not call a temp worker back or say they're on any hours to someone who complains or is trying to do something about it. That the fact that it's so uniform actually has led some folks to say, you know what, it's not just like this employer or that employer or this warehouse. Everywhere I go,
no, it's systemic.
The treatment's like this, and so in some ways it's a depressing reality. On the other hand, some folks have taken the standpoint that, you know, there isn't a better place. You have to start here and sort of that these jobs actually could be pretty good jobs.
No, sure. Look, Gabriel, when I, you know, back in the mid-80s, I worked in a warehouse, made $9.50 an hour back in the 80s with health care, with a pension, with a say on the job. I worked for a hardware distribution company, and it was a hard, back-breaking job, but we made a reasonable amount of money for the time. We had a pension, we had health care, we had these things, and we had some security. We knew what our schedules were going to be. We had these things, and I remember watching what you're talking about spring up in the 90s and go through, you know, all the way through the 90s. And then really the pedal hit the metal during the Bush years in 2000, where the employers just then had the upper hand. And I would have to say that since the collapse in 2008, where people are now going, oh, I'm just glad I have a job, I'm not gonna raise my head, that things have had to have gotten exponentially worse, especially when you look at Amazon, the growth of Amazon and the power that they've got, and what is their model?
Yeah, you know, I think that's true, that it's not just that it's hard work and you come home tired and exhausted and you can get injured. It's all those things and the lack of sort of a payoff.
Yeah.
You know, so you're doing all this work and like one of the professors I interviewed told me that the average temp warehouse worker makes about $10,000 and change dollars a year, you know, lower than your average farm worker wage.
Jeez.
And so it can be kind of dispiriting. You know, on the other hand, not to just to look on the rosy side for a moment, a place like Inland Empire and other places that are situated where there's this huge boom in warehousing, those jobs kind of have to stay there now. You know, they're, at least for a while, they're centrally located, they're very strategic in terms of being able to ship goods to the rest of the country. Maybe so.
Let me stop you there for a second, because maybe so, because what we're seeing where I live now is we're starting to see some of these big huge warehouses come from, you know, just 20 miles away. We're starting to see the building that was, you know, going across borders and you know, pitting not just states against each other anymore, but actually local communities against one another. And creating this, okay, well, we'll just move down the road, and we know you don't have a car, we know you can't follow it, so we might move. And it's that kind of stuff to me is just despicable. And this idea that they can't move it, they really can, you know, just a county over or just a town over.
Yeah. Well, the buildings that they're doing in Southern California are like million square foot facilities. Amazon opened their first one last year, will open a second one this year, just about every big box store, and more now is being driven through fulfillment as well.
Yeah. No, because Amazon's going to that same day. They want to try and have eventually same day delivery so that they can destroy Walmart. And look, I'm not against destroying Walmart on a certain level, but I still believe that you have to have brick and mortar stores for people to work. And this, to me, from the employment standpoint, not looking good, because I believe that every job could be a very good job. If you had the rights, it's that simple. But lastly, I just one last question. You know, in looking back on your experience of doing this, what's the one thing that really that's going to stick with you? I mean, in every experience I've had, there's been one thing that grabbed me and said, "Wow, this shocked me," or this grabbed my attention. Anything like that?
I think what struck me was, aside from the sort of kind of intimidation or wage theft, or just the fact of how incompatible the two instructions we were given were, which were safety above all else and work as fast as you can in an area with heavy pallets being carried by forklifts and cherry pickers and working with heavy machinery. I think those two, on my last day of this project, where we're getting iPad Airs out for Apple. They're going on sale the next day, and we're rushing as fast as we could. And one of the workers' sleeve got stuck in one of the rollers for the taping machine, and there was this kind of metal gear circulating. And I had to kind of pull the machine while he tried to yank out his sleeve and his arm before his hand went into the machine. And it just sort of, you pull it out, you're like, you just averted like a bad accident. And then here comes another iPad Air, and you're back to work. It's just sort of, you have to keep turning them out. But I think what was most striking to me was the constant opportunity when you combine fast work with sort of dangerous work of getting injured.
Yeah, I guess that would stick with me as well. Gabriel Thompson, I appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks for sharing your experience.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. I've got to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Like me, I ain't never been on welfare. That's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep into Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? Ask Me members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
In this season of the fall harvest, Congress is proving once again that it is a very poor gardener. It keeps watering the weeds and pulling the flowers. A conference committee is presently meeting to hash out a new 5-year farm bill, and what a hash they're making of it. For some 40 years, one of the best flowers in the farm bill garden has been the food stamp program, a symbiotic benefit for poor people and farmers alike. Since the crash of 2008, that flower has been especially worthy, keeping millions of knocked-down families from plunging into full-tilt poverty. Yet, with joblessness unabated and poverty increasing, $5 billion was cut from food stamp benefits on November 1st, and the House now wants to yank $4 billion a year more from it, and subject recipients to drug testing and other gratuitous intrusions. Meanwhile, the same gardeners are watering the farm program's noxious weeds. Specifically, they're growing a $14 billion a year crop insurance subsidy that amounts to a guaranteed farm income for the largest, most profitable agribusiness operations. Indeed, while the House wants to force food stamp recipients to prove that their incomes are low enough to qualify for benefits, the crop insurance handout requires no means testing and has no limits on how much recipients can get. This means that billionaires who are only incidental farmers will be among the biggest beneficiaries. And those billionaires are to be given one more little Benny. The farm bill would let them get their subsidies in secret, preventing taxpayers from knowing who gets how much. This is Jim Hightower saying, you should not be punished for being poor, and you shouldn't be subsidized if you're a billionaire. To help plant some seeds of common sense in American farm policy, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's the Environmental Working Group at EWG.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, Visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
John, there's a real difference between venture capitalism and vulture capitalism. The fact of the matter is that he's going to have to face up to this at some time or another.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire. Ring of fire.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, I look at that, I listen to those stories, and I worked in warehouses for a number of years, and none of that stuff, and I guess anybody who's been through it, you go, well, no, it's not a surprise. It's what they've been getting away with for a long time. The sad reality is all of the bad practices. And I think Gabriel hit on this, that it's systemic. I mean, you had a couple of bad actors, and I remember back, I guess it was 88, when I had gone to look at changing jobs. I was working in the warehouse distributor, the hardware distribution center, and not making bad money. It was a decent job, a lot of overtime and a lot of perks and a lot of decent things that the union had negotiated and the company had negotiated for. But I remember going to a non-union place, and in fact, it was one of the, I'm not going to get into who it was, but it was one of these low-cost kind of supermarket stuff, you know, where you go and you bag your own stuff, and you see them in strip malls and stuff. Now, it's a huge chain. And I remember them going, okay, well, you know, you've got the experience. You know, we might hire you. Here's how this job works. And I remember back in the 80s, them going, okay, well, your clock is right here at the door. And when the truck hits the dock, you punch in. When you close the door on the trailer, you punch out, and you wait for the next one to come. So all of that waiting time or all of the time in between you loading and unloading the trucks, you was on your own time. So if it took an hour for, you know, the jockey to get a trailer in the door or someone to come in, you stood there on your own dime. And they paid reasonable. I mean, it was a little bit more than what I was making. But when you started looking at exactly how much are you giving up, you realized really quickly, at least, you know, guys back then did, realized really quickly it was a screw job. And they had a heck of a time finding anybody who was willing to work there. And they were okay with that, because they didn't want long-term people. They wanted a constant churning, a constant turnover, a constant in and out and through. They didn't want people. They wanted young guys, early 20s, no more than 25, go in there, bust, and then to the door. And I've always said, you know, what you look for in jobs as a whole for an economy are jobs that if that's what you want to do, well, you know what? That's the job you have, and it's something you might be able to do into older age. And I find it interesting that, you know, we're now setting up a business model, and you got the president even running around. Oh, Amazon's wonderful. We need to. I've gone into some of these places. There are very few people my age in these places, yet let alone anyone older than me. And you've got to wonder, given the fact that we're seeing a nation that's growing older, what's that mean for those jobs? What's it mean for those folks? Not good stuff. And, you know, it's interesting that Gabriel's done a bunch of these kind of things. He worked in a poultry. The reason we had reached out to him originally before I knew about this story was he had worked in a poultry plant, a slaughterhouse, if you will. And the conditions that he talked about the last time I talked to him were just horrible. And the thing that, you know, again, that sticks out from my conversation with him the last time I talked to him is he was saying at the one place he worked, they had an entire wall full of every different kind of over-the-counter painkiller you could get. You know, whatever it is that you could, they had a dispenser on the wall. And, you know, of course, it took quarters, I think. But, you know, because they knew you weren't going to last 6 months, and you weren't supposed to. And that's what bothers me. We're really becoming a disposable society, and we're looking at people in a disposable light. And look, there's no help from Washington. There's no help from Harrisburg. There's no help from the GOP in this country. They are bought and paid for by big business, and a good number of the Democrats as well bought and paid for. I just saw something the other day. You know, thank goodness, I don't even know that we should have given Congress a Thanksgiving recess, to be honest with you, because they haven't really done anything. And in fact, according to reports, this legislative session, this Congress, you know, you've heard of the do-nothing Congress. This Congress has only enacted 49 laws in its time in office. That's the fewest laws passed since 1947. That is the first year they kept record. Now, the actual do-nothing Congress, you know, the one in that they talked about in 1947, they had enacted 388 public laws by July of 1947. Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? Before we take a break, I wanted to share this. You know, you look at these warehouses, you look at this stuff, and you go, you know, these are supposed to be the jobs that are going to be here. And Gabriel hit on that. These are jobs that are going to, they have to stay. And my thing is, okay, they had to stay. How do we organize them? How do we make them good paying jobs? I saw this story that now that we have this deal with Iran, and this is something I'm sure you won't hear the right wingers complaining about, but evidently there's a, the beginning stages, the first steps, according to an Iranian newspaper, that Iran and the United States are establishing a joint chamber of commerce. And there are going to be direct flights from Iran to the U.S. And this joint Iranian-U.S. chamber of commerce, which is going to be launched, I guess, in less than a month, is going to open that pipeline. And for those people who, you know, back when I was a kid, the thought of buying anything from Vietnam, because they were our sworn enemies and we weren't going to do anything. Now we're buying all of our tennis shoes and all of our stuff from Vietnam. I'm telling you, in a couple years, the Iranian paradise, that's where we're going to be buying stuff from. And maybe that's where our big box retailers will go. Just absolutely, absolutely mind-blowing stuff, isn't it? Yep. I don't know. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Your thoughts after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next Hey, at 11 a.m. on April 2nd, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began the first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6th, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Month was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, you look at this time of the year with the big holidays and tomorrow, Thanksgiving, you're going to see these big box retailers and these businesses forcing their workers to come into work at straight time. You know, this idea of time and a half, double time. And I go back to my, you know, my grandmother. This is in my lifetime when my grandmother worked at a retail outlet there in Cleveland. And if they worked a holiday, Thanksgiving was never a possibility. Neither was Christmas. But Christmas Eve, if you worked Christmas Eve, you know, during that daytime, which they considered a holiday back then, we don't anymore. We just think it's another day to shop. Back then, you got the day's pay plus double time. So you literally got triple time for the work. And, you know, there was a disincentive then. And if you did work, you know, it benefited you. And the sad reality is, you know, the stories that I've been seeing, the people who are going to be working tomorrow, the ones who are going to be forced into this, are people who are, you know, they're struggling for hours. Hey, I don't want to do it, but I may not get any hours. Or I don't want to do it, but if I don't, they'll fire me. Because, hey, congratulations, it's an at-will state, and most of the country is an at-will employment situation. So you don't show up, there's the door. And to me, you know, that the idea that, you know, we're forcing people to work holidays, forcing people to work overtime, and you see a lot of this stuff. Oh, we'll give you comp time. You know, kind of leads to this whole idea of wage theft. And Lori Clausen over at Daily Kos Labor had an interesting piece not too long ago, I guess at the beginning of the month, that compared wage theft to robberies. You know, holding up the liquor store or holding up the gas station or, you know, holding up a bank. All of those combined from 2008 to 2009. All of the bank robberies, all the gas station heists, all the convenience stores that got knocked off, you know, all of that stuff, amounted to about $56 million. And according to her, wage theft in this country more than dwarfed that at well over $185 million. In fact, what she points out with information from the Economic Policy Institute is that, you know, almost 65% of low-wage workers have some form of wage stolen from them, taken from their paychecks every week. 26% say that they're effectively paid less than minimum wage, according to Lori Claussen's piece. She said that fully three-quarters of workers who are due overtime have part or all of their earned overtime wages stolen by their employers. In total, she writes, the average low-wage worker loses a stunning $2,634 in unpaid wages each and every year, 15% of their income. And you go, well, you know, hey, we'll turn them in. And this is what I love. People say, oh, I've got rights. I'll go after them. And good luck on that. Do you know how many enforcement officers there are in the country at the federal level to enforce wage theft violations? There's one person, one enforcement agent for every 141,000 workers. So, you know, just think of this from a purely logical standpoint. If I got a 1 in 141,000 person chance of being caught, how rampant do you think wage theft is going to be? She says that more than half of the states have cut wage enforcement staff in recent years, and some states have tried to eliminate the positions entirely. And she points to Missouri, where their labor department collected $200,000 in restitution for minimum wage violations and $500,000 for prevailing wage violations, saying that the Missouri Department of Labor issued over 1,700 violations, and the Republicans went nuts. 1,700 violations for child labor violations. And the Republicans went nuts, saying that the Department of Labor was being overzealous in prosecuting employers who cheat on prevailing wage, which is why, you know, you think about our transportation bill, why the Republicans in this state have gone after it. Because we know it's rampant. We know the wage theft in the prevailing wage, especially among workers who don't have unions to back them up, is rampant. We know that. In fact, I've talked to numerous people who said, yeah, you know, but what are you going to do? I need the job. We're an at-will state. And I always go back, well, that's why you carry that union card. And I guess if it's not you being cheated, I guess it's not a big deal, but the reality is a lot of people are. And if you allow an injustice like this to happen to one person, eventually it's going to be you too, because I'm a firm believer and we're all in the shark tank together. It just may not be my time of the month. The shark may not be interested in me today, but eventually it does turn and it does come after us, which is why you gotta have hardline rules, and you gotta have people to enforce it, which is why the people who tell us they don't believe in government, the first thing they do, destroy the regulators, shut down the agencies that will prevent this kind of stuff. Amazing wage theft, worse than bank robberies, convenience store heists. Jeez, what have we done? Let's take a quick break. Right back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Back to America. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some Whole Foods workers in Chicago are staging a one-day strike today to demand a fair system of scheduling that will allow them to enjoy Thanksgiving like millions of other Americans. They're being joined by the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, our Walmart, and other community allies. Whole Foods worker Matthew Camp says that retail workers are facing what he says is a disturbing trend of having to work through Thanksgiving and other holidays that used to be sacred time off to spend with family. Camp says this is why Whole Foods workers in Chicago are striking today.
The day before Thanksgiving, which of course is an incredibly busy day for a grocery store, essentially to make these two points. One,
that this tendency among large retailers is very disturbing, you know, that we feel everyone's entitled to this holiday. And secondly, that we include ourselves in that first proposal, that we also, having worked so hard for the holiday, are entitled to for time to travel, to see our friends, to see our families.
This strike for better schedules and holidays off is within the context of a larger struggle at Whole Foods.
We're organizing with the Workers' Organizing Committee in the Fight for 15 campaign for better working conditions, a better attendance policy. We don't have sick days at Whole Foods, and for better wages as well. That being said, this particular action, the day before Thanksgiving, is really something of our own design. We were inspired, as Whole Foods workers, we were inspired by the Our Walmart Black Friday strikes that have been going on for the past couple of years.
Supporters of comprehensive immigration reform are working to intensify political pressure on Republican U.S. House Speaker John Boehner to act on immigration reform. Since November 12th, SEIU's Alicio Medina, Dreamer and Mi Familia Vota's Christian Avia, and Daejeon Yoon have been fasting in a Fast for Families tent on Washington's National Mall. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez has been fasting for 40 days. They vow to continue their fast until they can no longer physically sustain it. A major new nationwide effort by civil rights, faith, and immigration reform groups is being launched to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. Pope Francis on Tuesday said capitalism is a new tyranny. He called on world leaders to act to address poverty and growing inequality. In an 84-page document, the Pope said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume free market economic growth will bring greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Pope Francis said that's never been confirmed by the facts, and meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. He said under this capitalist tyranny, the powerful feed on the powerless. Thanks to hundreds of listeners and some labor unions who responded to our emergency funding appeal, Workers Independent News is still here. Madison, Wisconsin, putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To make sure we stay here, become a solidarity sustainer by donating now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Divided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call our brothers and our sisters. And are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can rely on it. The time is time, fast aligning, no mistaking. For union resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened a sleeping giant. Come on, now we can do it. We need to revive, re-up the labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, we've been talking about a lot of organizing going on across the country last night. We were talking about what's going on out in California with the university workers, the campus workers, 22,000 of them for a one-day strike last week. 15,000 students joined them on the streets. And it's this organizing I think we need to be doing much, much more of in every sector. And for the last several years, I've been following this situation at NYU where the grad students have been trying to organize, trying to get a little respect in the work that they do. And it looks like maybe they're going to turn the corner, which is why I've asked Matt Canfield. He is a fifth-year PhD student in anthropology at NYU. He's also one of the organizing folks with the GSOC UAW. Matt, thanks for taking time for us.
You had me because we have just reached a historic agreement with the administration. We've been fighting for 8 years to win a contract back after it was not renewed in 2005. And we just made this agreement with the administration to recognize graduate workers as employees.
So, you know, what's the argument against graduate students not being employees?
Well, for a long time, private universities have tried to make the argument that grad workers are not employees, that they're instead students. And we've been fighting back. We say, actually, we're workers, that we want a democratic workplace. And in 2005, Brown University, under the Bush administration, appealed an NLRB decision that recognized us as workers. And the Bush administration, NLRB, said we are not workers. So we've been fighting back. We've been pushing hard through both the community, through political leaders, and just some grassroots organizing with grad workers, and after 8 years, we've finally turned the corner.
So let me ask you, what's that going to mean then? Let's say you get the recognition. What does it mean for grad workers? What does it mean for the students? What's it going to mean for you?
Well, when we had our last contract, we raised wages and stipends by 38% across the university. And since that time, it's just been the cost of having a union have been too high. Without collective bargaining rights, our health care costs have increased by 33% just last year, and we just think that the future is too precarious if we don't have a voice. So we're really looking forward to bargaining over wages and stipends, but also some of the other aspects, like having a fair and a neutral grievance process through which we can resolve some of the disputes that we have had.
Now, I'm assuming the university wouldn't be thrilled with this because I'm sure they're quite happy with the former dictatorial control they've had.
That's right. They have been happy with the situation. But, you know, as grad workers, we've said enough is enough. And in the last couple of years, we've been pushing really hard. And I think what this is really going to do is inspire a wave of organizing across private universities. I know that I've had conversations in the past with other private university grad workers, and they have been waiting on this NLRB decision. And I think by stepping forward, showing that we don't have to wait, we can form unions now, is really going to push them to push up the organizing.
Yeah, and you look at this and you think of all of the attacks that have been going on for the last couple of years against the NLRB, this dreaded, the tyrannical NLRB, as Rand Paul put it, and you know, putting it as a matter of freedom versus tyranny, the fact that you just want to have a say in where you spend your life and where you do your work.
That's right. I mean, we're just looking to have a democratic workplace. And it is unfortunate that we've had to wait so long for the National Labor Relations Board to make a decision. I mean, we've been waiting for 3 years for this. And we're happy that we finally have been able to form an agreement with the administration. You know, we still have some unresolved issues. There are 350 RAs, research assistants, who are not going to be able to join the current union. But we think that once we have a more productive relationship with the university, that we'll be able to push forward and hopefully represent them in the future.
Why can't they be represented?
Well, they can't be represented because the university still is contesting the fact that they're employees. Now, I've talked to a lot of research assistants, and these are research assistants usually in the hard sciences, things like neurosciences, psychology, and they see their work as work. University is still saying no, they're not. And so it's going to be up to us to make that case.
Well, let me ask you this, you know, in going to the classic sense of an employee, who sets their schedule, who sets their tasks? I mean, is this stuff that's dictated by the university? Because if it is, then to me it seems pretty cut and dry.
Yeah, and it would seem cut and dry, I think, to most people. But the thing is, the universities have been really pushing back, and this has just been something that private and public universities have been saying they don't accept. Now, the thing is, we have public universities which have had unions for a long time. Like you said before, University of California, University of Washington, University of Massachusetts, they all have unionized RAs, and it works great. And they recognize that this is work, that this is employment. So we don't really understand why the university doesn't recognize this. But in terms of moving forward right now, we're building a democratic union that we're excited about. And we think that there's going to be an opportunity in the future to push forward and include those research assistants who are not included currently.
Yeah, if I remember right, Jack Lew's name pops into my head when I think about it. Did he have something to do with all of this?
Well, I
think that at one of the universities, he was instrumental in trying to crush this whole thing, wasn't he?
I think, yes, you're right. I mean, he was part of the NYU administration. And the NYU administration has faced increasing criticism from many of its different constituencies, from faculty, from the community, and from other people who just see some of the compensation of the administration as too large. Now, as a union, we don't really have an official position on this. We're excited to move forward in terms of our ability to form a union, but certainly NYU is facing increasing pressure across different constituencies.
Well, let me ask you this, Matt. I mean, you're looking for a PhD or working towards a PhD. Did you ever think that you would be part of, you know, at any point in your life? Do you have any union background? I guess the first question. And did you think that you would be doing this at this juncture in your life?
No, you know, I didn't ever think about this. But, you know, when it comes down to it, union supporter, I think the most powerful thing is rank and file organizing. And for us at NYU, that has been kind of where grad students can organize. We've been putting our efforts into building a powerful and democratic union.
Because, you know, I talk to a number of people who are getting involved in these things, and they go, you know, I didn't have any union background, didn't know much about it, but once I got involved, understood that this is actually pure democracy. It's workplace democracy. It's actually having a voice where I spend the majority of my life, even if, and I don't know how long you plan on staying in the position you're in, but even if it is, I'm only going to be here 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road, I'm going to leave something better for the person behind me.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things really at NYU that has increased our effort and really empowered us was actually partly the Occupy movement. You know, a lot of people were involved in the Occupy movement in New York, and they turned to making the places where they work more democratic. For me, it's been incredibly powerful to be part of those movements.
So let me ask you, you know, you're teaching a lot of the 100-level courses, I understand, right? Isn't that what you guys do?
Yeah, grad employees teach a lot of the 100 type of level courses, some of the upper level courses, and then, of course, do research.
Right. So, you know, I look at this, and I got to wonder what the people who are sitting in the classrooms think of this, and are you getting support from them as well? Because at some point, they've got to be looking at this going, well, that's going to be me someday, and I hope they do well so I don't have to fight that battle.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, in 2005, when we lost our contract, grad workers were on strike for a whole semester, and we had a lot of sympathy from the undergraduate population. And I think it's going to be part of our task in the next few weeks as we get near to an election to really push them to think about these issues as their issues also. And hopefully it's an incredibly educational opportunity for them to learn about the importance of workplace organizing.
Yeah, you know, because I look at this, and this is an opportunity to reach the younger generation. You know, I'm 46, and growing up as a kid, you know, I knew the way to get out of the housing project I grew up in was to get a job, a union job, that was going to pay a decent wage with health care and retirement security and those things. And I think the generation growing up now, and maybe, you know, just the past generation, they don't have that view of labor. They don't have that view of unions. They've been told time and time again, oh, the big union bosses are just stealing. And in my experience, that's not true.
Yeah, and I think this can be that kind of opportunity for them. And I think it also points to the fact of what you said in your opening, that really we're seeing a wave of organizing and a resurgence in the labor movement. And that's what I'm really hoping that, you know, our push to organize graduate workers is part of that wave.
Yeah, because, you know, you got to look at what's going on to college students right now. The massive amounts of debt they're being saddled with. I saw, you know, $1 trillion across the country in student loan debt. Coming out of college, the opportunity not there, still living in their parents' basement, is how the narrative is. You would think that there would be a mass wave of organizing, and I'm glad to see, you know, at NYU and at other places we're seeing that. I would love to see an awful lot more, but I'm glad to see something.
Yeah, I agree, and certainly the issue of student debt is hugely important for undergraduates, especially to get involved in organizing around. NYU is no stranger to that conversation. We've had undergraduates organizing around that issue because, you know, we are one of the most expensive private universities. So the pressure is going to have to come from all different sides, and certainly that's one important way that undergrads and younger folks can plug into this.
Yeah, so going forward, I understand you're going to have an election soon. Is this an NLRB election, or is this just an election for the – explain what's going on.
So we're going to have – after we've signed this agreement, we're going to have an election on December 10th and 11th, and it's going to be run by the American Arbitration Association.
Okay.
And part of the benefit of this agreement that we've laid out is that NYU is ready to sit down and come to the table and bargain in good faith right away. You know, these NLRB decisions, sometimes the employers fool around, they wait to bargain, and here we're going to have commence bargaining immediately. So we're thinking that after we win this election, we might have a union by the end of the academic year.
Wow, that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, then you start negotiating and back to work. And to me, that's the part that I think most people think that these have to be adversarial relationships. And in my years of being a union member, it's not always that way. In fact, when things work best is when you both agree that, you know, hey, the union's there, we're going to use it when we need it. But for the most part, we have a common goal. And you have a common goal with the university as well. And once you get past this, I think that's the best situation.
That's right. I mean, when we signed our first contract back in 2002, our president said that it made the university significantly more competitive. And this time when we signed the agreement, the UAW and the university administration came out in a joint statement recognizing the benefits to the entire community to have a fair, democratic workplace for its graduate workers. You know, as grad employees, we are hardworking employees. We're going to go back to work, but we care about NYU as the school we attend. And so having a voice in the decisions that affect our experience is part of kind of that mutual trust that we're building to work together to make the university a better place for everybody.
Yeah, and I wish you nothing but the best of luck. And when it comes down, I'd love to hear back how it goes, and hopefully, at the like you said, by the end of the academic year, you will have a contract and you will be moving forward.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate the time, Matt Canfield. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
You know, I look at this as you know, a perfect opportunity to highlight the fact that we need to be doing much more organizing. We need to be much more people into the streets. Great. That's a fantastic story in my view. And I'm glad that Matt took a little time for us. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Got the talk.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
In this season of the fall harvest, Congress is proving once again that it is a very poor gardener. It keeps watering the weeds and pulling the flowers. A conference committee is presently meeting to hash out a new 5-year farm bill, and what a hash they're making of it. For some 40 years, one of the best flowers in the farm bill garden has been the food stamp program, a symbiotic benefit for poor people and farmers alike. Since the crash of 2008, that flower has been especially worthy, keeping millions of knocked-down families from plunging into full-tilt poverty. Yet, with joblessness unabated and poverty increasing, $5 billion was cut from food stamp benefits on November 1st, and the House now wants to yank $4 billion a year more from it, and subject recipients to drug testing and other gratuitous intrusions. Meanwhile, the same gardeners are watering the farm program's noxious weeds. Specifically, they're growing a $14 billion a year crop insurance subsidy that amounts to a guaranteed farm income for the largest, most profitable agribusiness operations. Indeed, while the House wants to force food stamp recipients to prove that their incomes are low enough to qualify for benefits, the crop insurance handout requires no means testing and has no limits on how much recipients can get. This means that billionaires who are only incidental farmers will be among the biggest beneficiaries. And those billionaires are to be given one more little Benny. The Farm Bill would let them get their subsidies in secret, preventing taxpayers from knowing who gets how much. This is Jim Hightower saying, you should not be punished for being poor, and you shouldn't be subsidized if you're a billionaire. To help plant some seeds of common sense in American farm policy, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's the Environmental Working Group at EWG.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As far as my 2008 compensation goes, you know, it was for my work in 2008. I do believe that it was comparable to compensation for people in positions like mine in the industry.
Could you tell us how much money you made in 2008 before you got the bonus?
My base salary, I believe, was $350,000.
now Treasury Secretary. And, you know, as I mentioned in the last segment, you know, one of the guys who tried to bust, tried to make it impossible for folks like Matt to organize and to have a voice on the job. And now he's our Treasury Secretary. How nice is that? Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Download the podcast there at the website. If you missed any portion of the program, Stitcher on the smartphone, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. New poll out from CNN. They find that less than 4 in 10 Americans believe the Affordable Care Act is a failure, with 53% saying that it's too soon to judge. And I'm one of those people who say it's too soon to judge. Really hasn't gone into effect yet. Now, the fact that the rollout of the website was a disaster to me. And as I said right from the beginning, my first thought on this is this is privatization run amok. And it was easy. And if you watch the Kangaroo hearings, well, you know, all of the corporate CEOs and their lackeys saying, well, it was the Center for Medicare Survey. It was them. That was their fault. Well, now the New York Times had an interesting piece recently. That paints a very different picture. It paints a picture of the months leading up to the launch of the website. And they point out that in late August, the woman who is the COO of the CMS, the Center for Medicare Services, was telling colleagues, you know, outright about the chief contractor, this CGI, and their pattern of excuses because they were missing every deadline. In fact, she said if we could fire him, we would. But that she couldn't. What they found out is vital components of this setup never secured, including sufficient access to data centers to prevent the website from crashing. So from the beginning, they've known about it for a while. They didn't have a backup system that could go live, especially one that didn't crash. And look, the reality is the weakness was never disclosed. And you look at this and go, this is privatization run amok. The report said the architecture of the system that interacts with the data center where the information is stored is so poorly configured that the entire thing must be redesigned. And they're saying this process could, you know, take months. And it's interesting that you now see HP is replacing Verizon, so maybe that's part of it. The story went on to say the initial assessment identified more than 600 hardware and software defects, the longest list anybody had seen, according to one person who was familiar with the project. And you go, 600 hardware and software defects. This is what happens when you have 55 for-profit corporations with their hands in it. Now, you may remember that one of the lines was, well, you know, the Center for Medicare Services, they said at the last minute they wanted new stuff. Well, according to this report, at the meeting on August 27th, when the government officials finally, oops, this isn't going to work, evidently threw out nearly 30 requirements, you know, things like a Spanish language version of the website, a payment system for insurers to receive government subsidies for policies that they sold. And the things that you would think would be in it, they tossed them, said, well, evidently we can't keep the site from crashing on the minimum thing, so these other things maybe has to go. So this idea, well, you know, hey, they were asking for more stuff, doesn't seem to hold up under scrutiny. In fact, you know, even after throwing out these requirements, the system failed a test of only 500 simulated users in late September. So now you've got this agency that's passed because it failed a test of 500 people going to it. Now we're talking some 50 million people in the country without health care, some 100 million underinsured. So I think at any given time you're going to have more than 500 people going to this website. So now you've got these agency officials. They're panicking. And they sent out this urgent order to almost double the system's capacity. But the site was still down more than half the time until mid-October. Now, you look at this, and again, you go back and you think about how much money we've spent on this, how much money went to these contractors. And this is, to me, where starve the government mentality. This, to me, is where starve the beast has done such an enormous disservice to our country. The fact that we had to go out and get 55 for-profit companies from around the world to develop one website. And to have all, you know, what's that old saying, you know, too many chefs in the kitchen spoil the soup? This is one spoiled soup. And I find it really ludicrous that the people who are running around saying, well, we've exposed it, and the more I find out, the more I don't like, the more that our friends, our Republican friends, who are running around like somehow they want to save something. They want things fixed. We demand answers. When all along, they're the reason that things have been backed up. They're the reason that this couldn't be done in-house. They're the reason that you've had this massive brain drain from government. And the knowledge center to be able to do this and to be able to do it, I would argue, much cheaper than the hundreds of millions of dollars that we've spent. I think it was something like $630 million is one of the numbers I saw. And you go, you know, I think we could have probably done that a little bit better. Now, we're hearing all of these stories of all these cancellations. And it's, to me, I look at this and I go, you know, what I would be angry about is that for years I've been getting cheated. For years I've been getting screwed, and now I've got this crummy policy that, hey, maybe I can afford to get something better. Maybe it's a couple of bucks more, who knows? But the right, really, really going after and taking advantage of the hand, a small number of people whose policies are being canceled because, well, they're terrible policies. And you've got these employers who are now saying, well, you know, we're gonna do all of these different things. Like if you have a spouse, we're no longer going to cover your family. We're only going to cover an individual. We're no longer going to offer family coverage. And if we do, it's going to cost you a fortune. And we're going to raise the deductibles. And we're going to do all of these things. And you can go through story after story. And there are numerous stories of companies doing just this, saying, you know, well, we're going to kick all of the families off of these plans. And it's my belief that this is really to cause chaos. And I'm of the mindset that this right now, what's going on right now, should be a wake-up call to all of us to say, you know what, maybe Obamacare isn't the answer. Maybe the Affordable Care Act isn't the answer. Maybe we need to go much further. Maybe looking at what employers and these insurance companies are doing, the opportunism that we're seeing right before us, maybe now we should be going, explain to me why we have an employer-based healthcare system. I look at this Hobby Lobby nonsense. We're saying, well, we're not going to offer healthcare plans to families that have any family planning, any contraception in it whatsoever, because I have a religious exemption. Really? I mean, how far does that go? So to me, the answer in all of this is, if we're going to have employers who are going to abuse it, we take it from them. And I believe it should have never been in their hands in the first place, to be honest. Now, I understand, you know, the whole story after World War II, during World War II, they couldn't give raises, so healthcare benefits were something that they gave out so that they could be more competitive for workers, and it's something that, you know, that workers wanted to hold on to. I get that. But at a certain point, you got to go, now, especially now, when the costs are going through the roof and we're getting screwed with crummy plans and you're getting saddled with huge deductibles and high co-pays and all of this stuff, where we go, is this really something we should have in the hands of these employers? Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Now, I'm gonna work on Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some Whole Foods workers in Chicago are staging a one-day strike today to demand a fair system of scheduling that will allow them to enjoy Thanksgiving like millions of other Americans. They're being joined by the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, our Walmart, and other community allies. Whole Foods worker Matthew Camp says that retail workers are facing what he says is a disturbing trend of having to work through Thanksgiving and other holidays that used to be sacred time off to spend with family. Camp says this is why Whole Foods workers in Chicago are striking today.
The day before Thanksgiving, which of course is an incredibly busy day for a grocery store, essentially to make these two points. One, that this tendency among large retailers is very disturbing, you know, that we feel everyone's entitled to this holiday. And secondly, that we include ourselves in that first proposal, that we also, having worked so hard for the holiday, are entitled to for time to travel, to see our friends, to see our families.
This strike for better schedules and holidays off is within the context of a larger struggle at Whole Foods.
We're organizing with the Workers' Organizing Committee in the Fight for 15 campaign for better working conditions, a better attendance policy. We don't have sick days at Whole Foods, and for better wages as well. That being said, this particular action the day before Thanksgiving is really something of our own design. We were inspired, as Whole Foods workers, we were inspired by the Our Walmart Black Friday strikes that have been going on for the past couple of years.
Supporters of comprehensive immigration reform are working to intensify political pressure on Republican U.S. House Speaker John Boehner to act on immigration reform. Since November 12th, SEIU's Alicio Medina, Dreamer and Mi Familia Vota's Christian Avia, and Dae Jung Yoon have been fasting in a Fast for Families tent on Washington's National Mall. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez has been fasting for 40 days. They vow to continue their fast until they can no longer physically sustain it. A major new nationwide effort by civil rights, faith, and immigration reform groups is being launched to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. Pope Francis on Tuesday said capitalism is a new tyranny. He called on world leaders to act to address poverty and growing inequality. In an 84-page document, the Pope said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume free market economic growth will bring greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Pope Francis said that's never been confirmed by the facts, and meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. He said under this capitalist tyranny, the powerful feed on the powerless. Thanks to hundreds of listeners and some labor unions who responded to our emergency funding appeal, Workers Independent News is still here in Madison, Wisconsin, putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To make sure we stay here, become a solidarity sustainer by donating now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, for undivided we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call on our brothers and our sisters. And are you and I the win? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is prime, past the line ain't no mistaking. Reunion resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened a sleeping giant. Come on now, we can do it. We need to revive, react, and re-up the labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. You know, as we've been talking about here on the program, there's been an assault on public sector workers, on unionized workers across the country. And, you know, pensions being one of the main tack points right now, especially here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, as the most unpopular governor in the country says he's going to set his sights now on those public sector pensions. And the idea is, let's cut the people who are receiving pensions now. Retroactively go back and change those contracts. These are the people who tell us they believe in the rule of law. Kind of makes you wonder. But I saw a piece on multi-employer pension funds across the country, of which unions are the main groups that are involved in these. And I said, you know, this is somebody we need to be talking to. And I got Cole Stangler. He's a staff writer over at In These Times. He's written a piece on multi-employer pension funds called A Fight Builds Over Multi-Employer Funds. Cole, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
So, you know, right now you see this attack on pensions across the country, be it public sector pensions, be it, private sector pensions of people who've gone through bankruptcy. All of this stuff And, you know, I look at the contracts, the agreements that we've made with past generations. If you work for lower wages, you know, you'll have a pension. Now we seem to see that wanting to be taken away. I'm curious what you found in your research.
Right. You know, so my piece looks at, you know, there's a proposal that finally, after a couple months of trying to fine-tune this, ready to hit the floor soon. And this is a proposal that's been crafted by a group called National Coordinating Committee for Multi-Employer Plans, made up of some labor unions, some employers, and pension trustees. Basically, this plan would reverse what's a long-standing rule of private pension law, you know, which is, would effectively reverse the cutback rule and allow trustees to cut benefits to current retirees. And ostensibly, this proposal is to shore up, you know, the long-term solvency of these plans, because multi-employer plans are facing about $27 billion in projected liabilities 10, 15 years, so $27 billion. And the idea is, in order to shore up and to fix those liabilities, you come up with some sort of plan that allows you to cut benefits to current retirees. And that's something that's been off-limits, part of the foundation of ERISA in 1974. And so my article looks at, now there's finally some mounting union opposition to this plan. You have basically the other thing about this, which I should point out too, is that there's $27 billion in unfunded liabilities, and that's what the proponents of this plan talk about. And you have to somehow address that.
Right.
But the other thing about it is there's only a couple of big plans that are making up those liabilities. $20 billion of that comes from the Teamsters Central States Fund. Another $6 billion comes from the United Mine Workers Fund. So basically, you have two big plans that are contributing most of those unfunded liabilities. And so what some of the unions are saying that are opposed to this plan, this proposal that should be hitting the floor soon, is, well, if you could come up with some sort of alternative fix to address, you know, these couple of plans, you know, the last thing we should be doing is cutting benefits to current retirees.
And I agree.
There's a good reason why that's part of the law, you know.
And I look at this, and, you know, for me, a big portion of this comes because, you know, we had that huge collapse in 2008.
Right.
And for me, at the end of this, you go, maybe we should be helping these plans become more solvent. And for me, being a union member, maybe by getting people to organize and actually paying into these funds and bringing more people into it would actually help as well. Because what's happened to these funds over the years is we've seen employers, along with our broken labor laws, you know, basically destroying these funds by not by fighting workers' ability to organize and participate in these funds. So that's
right.
To me, that's the crux of this whole argument.
Right. You know, and there, I mean, there are ways to fix this too. You know, the number of different groups are raising. Notably, the AARP has been pretty adamant about this, Pension Rights Center, some of the labor unions also, that these are proposals that aren't being talked about right now, which is you could get a federal bailout, which is the first option. We all know how tough that's going to be.
No, it's not going to happen in this political culture.
in the climate right now. That's true. Another alternative fix could be trying to get these plans to merge also. You know, having some of the financially troubled plans like Central States merge with plans in better shape, like, say, the Western States Fund. You could increase the premiums also that these plans play. Unlike single employer pension plans, multi-employer plans actually pay very low premiums right now to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is the FDIC equivalent. So, you know, you could also extend some low-interest loans. You know, these are all kind of short-term small fixes that people are trying to float around here.
Right. Now, I mean, if you're willing to give a railroad company a 250-year loan for a $250 billion and guarantees, we should be able to help make sure that workers in their final years have some retirement security. And, you know,
right.
I look at, you know, you brought up the mine workers. The assault on the mine workers by Patriot Coal and that whole Peabody Coal thing to me is just, it's actually criminal in my view. But, you know, it's what's been allowed to happen in this country for a couple of generations now, where those promises that we made to that generation have been allowed to, well, be wiped away with the stroke of a pen. And I think of all of my friends who worked at Bethlehem Steel with one stroke of the pen lost 60% of their pension because they ended up on the back of the PBGC, and they could have paid. And that's right. The other part that drives me insane is it's always easy to go, well, you know what? This happened. It's time to screw the guy at the bottom.
Right. And, you know, this gets another big problem with this, which is, you know, unions aren't necessarily always looking out for the retirees, and that's been part of the problem here. That, you know, and I would venture to say, too, that the reason why the Teamsters are now finally on the record, or at least part of it, is because, you know, you have grassroots, I mean, you have retirees who get really pissed off about this, because if you talk to, you know, I talked to a retiree who's, you know, in his early 70s, he's getting a $3,000 pension from Central States, and he's had cancer, you know, and he said, you know, what am I supposed to do if I don't have this pension? I'm, you know, just had cancer, 70 years old, when I work at Walmart, you know, that's not going to cut it. And so I think you have a bunch of pissed off retirees here too, because it's for good reason, because, you know, that this is a lifeline to them. It's been promised to them.
No, but you know, here's the thing. I mean, you know, I talk to a lot of folks who, during the 80s, especially in the 80s and 90s, when we were seeing mega mergers and the Mitt Romney type bankruptcies, where, you know, they would run companies through bankruptcy to shed their legacy costs, and all those workers got screwed out of their pensions. You know, there are a lot of people are looking, well, it happened to me. Why shouldn't it happen to them? And I think that's kind of a backwards mentality. Instead of saying, you know, it happened to me, it shouldn't have, but it shouldn't happen to anybody else.
Right. Right. Yeah, and you know, I also want to mention too is part of the problem with this proposal is that it's a slippery slope, and that's why unions that wouldn't necessarily be affected by this. So, for instance, you know, the machinist union, which doesn't have a plan that's facing insolvency anytime soon, or even the boilermakers, which is a much smaller union, they see this as a really slippery slope, because if you give trustees the ability to cut benefits to retirees and, you know, trustees of really financially troubled plans, multi-employer plans, what's to say that, you know, 10 years or so, single-employer trustees aren't going to want to cut those benefits too and say, well, you know, Congress gave the authority to these other financially troubled plans. This is the best solution. Why can't we be granted this too? So, and that's why I think it's in a much larger context here, a bigger story about, as you were referencing earlier, it's a, you know, there's a war on pensions going on in this country. This is a small part of it, but you know, if you start rolling back four pieces of legislation, the foundation of private pension law, you know, it opens the door to some really scary stuff down the road.
Yeah, and then you got to wonder, you know, if they're going to be able to do it to the private sector, which is where they roll this stuff out. What happens to the public sector? What, the cops, the firefighters, the teachers? I mean, here in Pennsylvania, they've been, there's this huge, massive unfunded liability that if everybody retired today, if everything stopped at this moment, this is what we would have to pay out. And the thing is, I hear these unfunded liability numbers, and yeah, we've always had a certain number that's been associated with unfunded liabilities. That's if everyone retired at this very moment and it had to pay out every cent at this very moment. Yeah, there's a huge liability, but there are a couple of other parts to this, right? I mean, if the economy starts to turn around and the investments that they made, you know, have decent returns, maybe that liability comes down a bit. Or are these plans that you're talking about in such bad shape that doesn't even help?
Well, no, I mean, you know, people were talking about, people in support of this proposal were talking about how the financial crisis really ravaged these plans. And I think, you know, looking at the stats, it was 75% of plans were considered healthy before the crisis. It went down to 30% by the start of 2009. And now, just 2 years removed from that, it's back up to 60% of those plans are considered stable. So you already have, you know, a slight recovery. That's part of it. Yeah. You know, there's also a bigger problem, too, which is the sadder part, or at least the more difficult part to address, which is there's a structural problem of you don't have enough workers that are paying into multi-employer plans, and that's just the reality of it today. You have less and less unionized workplaces. So, you know, it's a difficult situation.
And I agree, and this is where the part of me says there should be, and I've always been an advocate of one pension plan to make sure that what the whole concept was supposed to be of ensuring risk by having a large number of people in the plan. It should have been one fund in my view all along, but that's, I don't know legally if that was something that was ever going to be allowed to happen.
Right. I mean, you know, another piece of the puzzle, there's so many different kind of smaller parts about of the story, you know, but the PBGC, which is the government agency that insures these plans, so unlike the FDIC, which insures bank accounts, deposits up to $250,000 for regular people, for Americans, the PBGC doesn't actually cover, you know, the entirety of those promised benefits.
About 40%, if I remember right.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on how many years you paid in and so forth. But if you could also get the PBGC to assume full responsibility, you know, that'd be one way of ensuring the long-term solvency of this. Basically, having the PBGC say, well, you know, these benefits were promised, we're going to have to pay them and have it assume responsibility.
Yeah, and for me, that I don't think that's going to happen, because in this political climate, and maybe you'll disagree, I don't think anything that's going to benefit the workers is going to be at the top of the, at least the House majority's priority list. And I go back and I look at what the arguments against helping the auto industry and the insanity that ensued afterwards, because a lot of my very conservative friends were against helping the auto industry because
right.
those workers didn't take enough of a bath. They didn't lose all of their pension. They didn't lose all of their benefits and all of their wages. They lost a good portion of it, but they didn't lose all of it. And that's just,
right.
to me, is the wrong mentality.
Right. I mean, you know, you mentioned the political climate. You know, another bad part about this, too, is that the guy who's actually one of the top lobbyists on this upcoming bill, Earl Pomeroy, who was a former congressman from North Dakota, a couple years ago, he helped lead the effort in the House, along with, I think it was Senator Casey in the Senate, to basically get a bailout for the PBGC. And so he was working on this legislation because he, you know, saw this upcoming fiasco. I mean, through about 10, 15, 20 years before the plans run out. And he had tried to help craft a bailout, basically, in the House. That failed. This is the time of the GM bailout, the rise of the Tea Party. Rush Limbaugh was going nuts on his show about this proposal. So Earl Palmer loses his election. And now he's the head lobbyist on this new bill, and because his argument is basically there's no, you know, there's no stakes in the political climate today. So maybe the best case scenario if you're a retiree is to maybe stave off the worst from happening in the next couple of years. Maybe wait for, you know, something better to happen in Congress so you get a better climate for that. But you know, there's no people who work on this issue, especially the multi-employer plan. You know. It's a really bad situation, tough situation. So I think people are trying to stave off the worst from happening right now.
Yeah, as I've been telling people, it's a bad time to be a worker in this country.
Yeah.
Because the assaults seem to be coming from every direction, and it's just, I guess this is just one more thing. Cole Stengler, I appreciate you taking time for us, fill us in on this important issue. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Already, you know, I look at this, and again, you go back and just part of it. As he pointed out, you know, what happens? What happens if they get this? You know, what happens? The public sector pensions next? That's kind of the question. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
In this season of the fall harvest, Congress is proving once again that it is a very poor gardener. It keeps watering the weeds and pulling the flowers. A conference committee is presently meeting to hash out a new 5-year farm bill, and what a hash they're making of it. For some 40 years, one of the best flowers in the farm bill garden has been the food stamp program, a symbiotic benefit for poor people and farmers alike. Since the crash of 2008, that flower has been especially worthy, keeping millions of knocked-down families from plunging into full-tilt poverty. Yet, with joblessness unabated and poverty increasing, $5 billion was cut from food stamp benefits on November 1st, and the House now wants to yank $4 billion a year more from it, and subject recipients to drug testing and other gratuitous intrusions. Meanwhile, the same gardeners are watering the farm program's noxious weeds. Specifically, they're growing a $14 billion a year crop insurance subsidy that amounts to a guaranteed farm income for the largest, most profitable agribusiness operations. Indeed, while the House wants to force food stamp recipients to prove that their incomes are low enough to qualify for benefits, crop insurance handout requires no means testing and has no limits on how much recipients can get. This means that billionaires who are only incidental farmers will be among the biggest beneficiaries. And those billionaires are to be given one more little Benny. The Farm Bill would let them get their subsidies in secret, preventing taxpayers from knowing who gets how much. This is Jim Hightower saying, you should not be punished for being poor, and you shouldn't be subsidized if you're a billionaire. To help plant some seeds of common sense in American farm policy, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's the Environmental Working Group at EWG.org. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Yeah, you're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science of man-made global warming was not climate science, it was political science.
This is the end. My only friend, the end.
Yeah. I love a politician who tells you that I'm a firm believer of keeping my head in the sand. I love that. That to me is just golden. Anyway, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. The proven record of success. That's kind of, I guess, why investors spent millions of dollars to promote this movie, The Christmas Candle, which had been billed as a timeless holiday film for the entire family. Yeah. Spent millions of dollars. Critics not too happy with the Rick Santorum movie. Rick got thumped in the presidential election, got thumped in the senatorial election, gave up the high paying gig at the think tank to be a war hawk. Because most of us have bored of that out of him. So he became one of the honchos over at this faith based film studio, Echo Light. And they came out with The Christmas Candle, a 100-minute movie with, some pretty big-name people. The guy from one of the main stars from Clash of the Titans, this Hans Matheson. Susan Boyle made her film debut, as the innkeeper's wife, and got the belt out a song, I guess. The reviews, not friendly. The New York Daily News said, this odd Dickens meets Sunday school movie is as artless as the setup is muddled. The New York Post said, this throwback made-for-TV style film takes the easy way out in a cheesy climax, but its resolute quaintness may appeal to the kind of viewer who regard electricity as disturbingly newfangled. The Arizona Republic called it resolutely stiff and hollow. And I thought that was the best one, stiff and hollow. Something that if you look at Santorum, very much, very stiff, very hollow. Now, Santorum, not too thrilled, said that that Hollywood is the devil's playground, and not very happy at the critics' reviews. Maybe go out and see The Christmas Candle. And I know there are a lot of, I really thought, and as I guess so did the investors in this flop of a movie, who over the 2 week release, has made about $1.6 million, which is pretty pathetic, for, something that was really hyped up, especially in the faith-based community. So maybe they're not dupes after all. Maybe they're not maybe the evangelicals aren't aren't as naive as he would lead us to believe. Interesting story. I saw some headlines today. The Washington Times said that Obama Obama's call to close the Vatican embassy is a slap in the face to Roman Catholics. Drudge Report, Obama insults Catholic in Vatican embassy shutdown. The Daily Caller, another conservative rag, Catholics furious over Obama's plan to close Vatican embassy site. Breitbart reported that the Obama administration is trying to diminish and discredit the Vatican's role in the world because of its pro-life, pro-family, pro-religious values. And, you know, here's the thing. I don't know if they've noticed, but the right has been going after the Vatican, after the Pope, because of the Pope's wild assertions that, well, politicians should have dignified work for everyone, should have education and health care for everyone. I find it just amazing. Now, understand, much like most of the right-wing tizzies that we see, all of the vitriol and all of the heated rhetoric, not really true. Understand, we don't have an embassy in Vatican City. According to what I've seen and what the reports that I've seen and actually what I've seen of Vatican City, there's just no room for every country to have an embassy. And evidently we have an embassy to the Vatican, but it's in a house somewhere that they've renovated. They're now moving that location to the same place where they have the Italian embassy, the embassy to Italy. The U.S. Embassy in Italy, they're moving it to the same compound, which, oddly enough, is, from what reports say, about a tenth of a mile closer to Vatican City. So I find it really, really kind of comical that the folks who are all tore up, they're upset. We're closing the Vatican, closing our embassy. Just nuts. I did want to throw out one of the CEO retirement statistics. You know, in listening to the last and going over the last interview, having that rant run through my head. The CEOs in this country, man, they've never had it so well. Never had it so well. In fact, the CEOs who make up the business roundtable on average hold close to $15 million. A piece in their corporate retirement accounts, which evidently, according to reports, is about $86,000 a month. Each one of our captains of industry would pocket. David Cote, you may remember him, Honeywell, one of the business roundtable, fix the debt people. He's holding $134 million in his Honeywell retirement account. And they say that almost $800,000 a month. Now, understand, the typical U.S. worker within 10 years of retirement has about enough to generate $71 a month. And they want to destroy Social Security. You think about that one. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Changing America for the better. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and
His baseball cap said he was a cop, so he must...
WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some Whole Foods workers in Chicago are staging a one-day strike today to demand a fair system of scheduling that will allow them to enjoy Thanksgiving like millions of other Americans. They're being joined by the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, our Walmart, and other community allies. Whole Foods worker Matthew Camp says that retail workers are facing what he says is a disturbing trend of having to work through Thanksgiving and other holidays that used to be sacred time off to spend with family. Camp says this is why Whole Foods workers in Chicago are striking today.
The day before Thanksgiving, which of course is an incredibly busy day for a grocery store, essentially to make these two points. One, that this tendency among large retailers is very disturbing, you know, that we feel everyone's entitled to this holiday. And secondly, that we include ourselves in that first proposal, that we also, having worked so hard for the holiday, are entitled to for time to travel, to see our friends, to see our families.
This strike for better schedules and holidays off is within the context of a larger struggle at Whole Foods.
We're organizing with the Workers' Organizing Committee and the Fight for 15 campaign for better working conditions, a better attendance policy. We don't have sick days at Whole Foods, and for better wages as well. That being said, this particular action, the day before Thanksgiving, is really something of our own design. We were inspired, as Whole Foods workers, we were inspired by the Our Walmart Black Friday strikes that have been going on for the past couple of years.
Supporters of comprehensive immigration reform are working to intensify political pressure on Republican U.S. House Speaker John Boehner to act on immigration reform. Since November 12th, SEIU's Alicio Medina, Dreamer and Mi Familia Vota's Christian Avia, and Dae Jung Yoon have been fasting in a Fast for Families tent on Washington's National Mall. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez has been fasting for 40 days. They vow to continue their fast until they can no longer physically sustain it. A major new nationwide effort by civil rights, faith, and immigration reform groups is being launched to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. Pope Francis on Tuesday said capitalism is a new tyranny. He called on world leaders to act to address poverty and growing inequality. In an 84-page document, the Pope said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume free market economic growth will bring greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Pope Francis said that's never been confirmed by the facts, and meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. He said under this capitalist tyranny, the powerful feed on the powerless. Thanks to hundreds of listeners and some labor unions who responded to our emergency funding appeal, Workers Independent News is still here in Madison, Wisconsin, putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To make sure we stay here, become a solidarity sustainer by donating now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's intimidating, but it's nothing we are willing to back down on, you know? I mean, we're not just out there fighting for our own rights. When we're out there fighting a company like Walmart, we're fighting for every associate they hire worldwide.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, you look at Thanksgiving Thursday, the actions across the U.S., and historic actions at that, the fact that you had thousands of people taking to the streets, calling on Walmart to do much better for their employees. And I look at our quote of the day by Martha Yuval, one of the original folks here in the U.S. Who went out on strike against Walmart's supply chain, saying, "We were hungry, we were tired, and we were thinking. What if we could invite all the Walmart workers in the supply chain to do just a one-hour strike?" Think of the power, the power of all of those people globally coming together and calling on the world's largest corporation to do better, to treat their workers with a little bit of dignity and respect. Wow, how powerful that could be. And you know what? I think it's going to come to pass, which is why I've asked Elke Boesiger, head of commerce with the UNI Global Union. Well, Elke, thanks for taking time for me.
It's a pleasure to be on your show.
You know, I look at, you know, here on Thanksgiving, we saw across the United States, we saw workers in just about every state taking to the front of the stores and informing the customers, hey, this is the treatment working people here at Walmart have to endure, a historic moment. But I'd love to see that, and a lot of people would love to see that go global to draw more attention to this behemoth, this global behemoth.
It might actually be a surprise to your listeners, Rick, but Walmart is actually a company that is unionized in other parts of the world. We're working with unions in countries like Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and South Africa, where workers have already got a union at Walmart, where they have been able to get a voice on the job, and that's exactly what we believe workers in the U.S. Deserve as well. We believe that every worker who works for Walmart around the world should have the right to speak on the job and to lead a life that allows them to have a decent life, to have health insurance, to send their kids to college, and to make that move into the middle class. We just don't believe it's fair that people work very, very hard, and they are not able to afford a decent lifestyle from the money that they're earning.
Yeah, and that, the important part of that is, look, I mean, these are working people. These are people who get up every day. They punch the clock. They do the job. They create the wealth that in this country anyway, and a lot of other countries, the wealth is being accumulated by the handfuls. And I just saw something yesterday where the top four Walmart heirs have something like over $110 billion in accumulated wealth. And you go, that's made off the backs of low-wage workers, not only in the U.S., but in many other countries throughout the world.
That's exactly right. And, I mean, we're all very familiar with the profits that the company is making, that the owners of the company are making, and the shareholders, how they're benefiting from the all the money that the company is being making with their business model. But at the same time, We also believe that if the company just raised the wages a little bit so that all their workers could afford a decent lifestyle, that would increase the disposable income for those workers, which also would have a big, big impact on the economy in the United States as such. And we all know that the American economy could do with a bit of a boost just now.
Right.
And because there are so many people working at the company, it would have a big trigger-on effect. And I think Walmart would be the company who should look at that and who should, as a leader in their business, take responsibility also on that angle.
Yeah, I mean, by putting more money in their workers' pockets, it would have a huge stimulative effect, not only for the country, but I would argue for Walmart as well, because most of their workers, well, they shop there.
Absolutely. And what we're trying to do with this global alliance is to build a broad alliance of workers, of customers, of all kinds of different stakeholders who believe that everybody who works or shops at Walmart has a responsibility and also should have an interest in holding this company accountable.
So you pointed out a minute ago that in other countries, Walmart workers are unionized. And you know, those are countries that actually I think have probably better labor law than we have here in the U.S. If you look at our laws, they're kind of fractured and broken and, well, kind of outdated. In other countries, their labor laws aren't as antiquated as ours and actually have some teeth so workers can organize. Can you talk to that a little bit, maybe what other countries have that the U.S. doesn't?
Certainly there are countries out there where the labor law is more favorable for workers, but I don't think that's the only thing that is holding back workers in the U.S. to be organized, because there are a lot of companies, particularly in the retail sector in the U.S., that have a union, where workers do have a voice in the job. But Walmart in the U.S. is notoriously anti-union. They are scaring the workers from becoming unionized. But not only that, they're scaring workers from talking about the challenges that they're facing in their daily work on the job. And that's really where I think the company is not taking its responsibility serious. If it says we want to be a good employer for our employees, that also means that they have to listen to them and not retaliate against them if they raise issues. And often the issues that they're raising would actually be good for the business of the company. In other countries around the world, we have unions that have organized workers. They have collective agreements. If there are issues that need to be discussed, then the union and the company sit down together around the table and they resolve those issues. And I think that's what we're asking for the company to do in the U.S. as well.
Yeah, I'm with you. But you know, going back to our labor law here in this country, we seem to with the number of stalls and delays and the punitive and the small amount of penalties that a company would face for the retaliation and the harassment and discrimination, it almost encourages it by not having strong enough laws against it.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think it's absolutely not in the interest of the American society, the American economy, those anti-union laws, because looking at the situation of the companies where unions are represented, the workers are usually better off there, which means they have a more disposable income, which means they can spend more money, and that would be good for the entire society and for the entire economy.
Yeah, you know, I go. My grandmother worked as a like a cashier at Walmart at a very small department store in the Cleveland area from the late 1950s all the way up until 1987. And I was looking at, because she was a member of a union here in the U.S., the UFCW, and I was looking at some of their contracts, and the wages that she was paid in 1987 were higher than they are today, and she had full health care, 6 weeks vacation, paid sick time, full, you know, eye, dental, all of that, and a pension that she's collecting to this day. And I look at Walmart, who has made their, well, made their massive profits off of taking those things back. And also, you know, making sure that jobs are being outsourced and we're squeezing every penny out of the supply chain. And I say, you know, the economy that my grandparents built with a strong, burgeoning middle class, that's what we should be looking to replicate, not this Walmart version.
Absolutely. I believe that the American people should actually be ashamed for Walmart to be the business model that is being upheld and promoted everywhere. They should be ashamed of the development that you have just described, because if you are not able to live off the job that you are doing, and the workers at Walmart are very committed, they're working very, very hard, and they still cannot afford healthcare for their children, they still cannot afford to send their children to college. That is something that that the company should be ashamed of, and particularly if you think that those who are the decision makers in the company, they are certainly well covered, they have healthcare, and they take so much money home that they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah, you know, we had a guy who was just elected to Congress, Alan Grayson. He was reelected, you know, after a term off. And he said, you know, you look at, you know, the largest recipient of public aid. You want to talk about a welfare queen? Well, that welfare queen is Walmart, because they are the largest recipient of public tax dollars, be it through healthcare, be it through heating assistance, food stamps, all of these social programs. And it's we, the taxpayers, who are subsidizing this low-wage model. And at some point, I'm hoping the American people wake up to the reality that we're subsidizing the largest global corporation to continue a low-wage model.
That's right. There is something fundamentally wrong with the way the taxes are being paid in the U.S. and the way subsidies are being handed out to companies. And I hope that that the government and the different parliamentarian institutions that you have and the people themselves will wake up one day and demand a change to that situation.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Alka Boseger, head of commerce with the UNI Global Union. You know, Alka, you know, when I look at this, I guess my question for you, as being the head of this global organization, how does the rest of the world view what's going on here? I mean, does the rest of the world look to us, the U.S., as the leader and, hey, this is the direction we should be going? Or are they looking at us going, hey, what are you doing? This is the race to the bottom. You're pulling us all down.
I think the world looks at the U.S. as a model on in many ways, but certainly not when it comes to labor relations and worker rights. From the point of view of the unions and the workers that we're working with, because what we're doing as UNI is connecting workers, connecting unions in the leading multinational retailers. And what we're seeing is that the U.S. is really, less almost than a developing country, I could say, in terms of the rights that it grants to its workers.
So how much of this is directly related to our insane trade policies in this country, this whole neoliberal free trade mantra?
I'm not sure about that. The funny thing is that with the labor laws being so weak in the United States, at the same time, the U.S. government demands very strict conditions from countries that they're trading with. So there is a real imbalance here, and because the U.S. is so big and so powerful, they can put those conditions on their trading partners, but they don't abide by these same conditions in their own country.
Right. Absolutely. Let me ask you this. You know, I saw the tragedy that happened in Bangladesh, and, you know, Walmart and everybody else ran away. Oh, we don't deal with those folks, even though we know they do deal with a lot of situations in those countries, very extremely low-wage sweatshop countries, where I think that, you know, by having their buying power, by having their power around the world, they can actually lift those conditions up for those workers and make sure that stuff doesn't happen. Yet I fear that we're not doing enough.
That's exactly right. I mean, but the way that Walmart is keeping the prices for the product that it sells low is by seeking complete control over its supply chain. And nobody can tell me, with the control that they're exercising over their supply chain, that they don't know where from which factories they're sourcing from. So I think that the reaction that we saw from Walmart to the fire, for instance, in Bangladesh was a very, very weak one. And even if you outsource jobs to other companies, you have a responsibility as the client for the conditions that are happening in that supplier, and particularly because Walmart were aware of issues at that company, and they have rather than having taken action to get those conditions changed and improved, they just walk away from it, and that's absolutely irresponsible.
Yeah, but it's at the end of the day, their concern and what they'll tell you is our commitment is to the lowest price for our consumers, even if those consumers are workers who don't make sufficient wages to buy those. It's just really this snowballing downward, this terminal velocity free fall to the bottom, not even a race.
That's right. And they're playing with the situation that workers in the U.S. have less disposable income for the own goods that they're buying. So they're trying to keep their clients by lowering their own prices even further. And the only way they can do that is by putting even more pressure on their supply chain and the manufacturers in those countries. But, you know, I believe if consumers are just a little bit more interested in where the goods are coming from that they are buying, they would find that it is unacceptable under the conditions under which many of these goods are being produced. And it's not actually, it wouldn't be a big deal for either for Walmart or for consumers to pay 10 cents more, and that may help workers in the supply chain to work under different conditions.
Yeah, I agree. Next Friday, I understand the Global Day of Action. Tell me what's the Day of Action going to entail? How big are you hoping this is going to get, and what are the demands?
The Global Day of Action that we're running on the 14th, 15th of December next week is a global day of action where all the unions and the workers that we're uniting in our Uni Global Walmart Alliance to demand respect and a voice on the job for Walmart workers around the world. We are working with our unions in all the countries where workers are unionized to run actions in their own countries, in Walmart stores in their countries, and there will also be actions happening in the United States. And we don't see this just as a solidarity day for workers in the United States, but we see this as an opportunity to highlight the anti-union, anti-worker policies of the company, and we're going to answer with actions, and we're going to continue to demand from Walmart that they behave responsibly as the global leader in the retail industry.
Yep. Well, what's the follow-up to the Day of Action? I mean, obviously, this is going to be a big day where we're hoping to get as many people out into the streets and highlighting, but where do you go from there? I mean, at the end of the day, what we've seen out of Walmart here in the U.S. is that they minimize, well, this is just a handful of disgruntled people. How do you move that to the next step?
We're in discussions with a lot of different groups who are uniting around this issue of improving conditions for workers at Walmart. There are unions involved, community groups, groups of faith who are joining together because they believe it's no longer acceptable for Walmart to get away with the minimum conditions, the bad conditions that they're giving to their workers. And we believe that a company like Walmart that is the global leader in the industry, that it's time for them to sit down and ensure that workers, wherever they have stores, have decent working conditions and decent rights.
And wherever they have products manufactured in their supply
Absolutely.
Chain.
Absolutely, throughout the entire supply chain, of course.
Because if this one company, I mean, just think about this, if this one global company would say, well, we're going to raise up everyone else, they would have to bring everyone with them, or am I off base?
That's exactly why it's so important for us to improve conditions at Walmart. They are the global leader. They are setting the standards. They are the model for providing the business model for retail. It's because of them that standards in the retail industry have gone down, and that's why it's so important for us that we get Walmart to accept that they have a responsibility not just for their own workers but for the entire industry.
What do you say to the people who said, well, it's a competitive market, you know, it's a free market, and if Walmart wants to do better, they may want to do better, but you know what? The rest of the industry just won't let them. The Targets and the Kohl's and the Dillard's and all of these other chains, they're going to continue to the race to the bottom, even if Walmart takes a different path. What do you say to those folks?
It's certainly a very, very difficult question, and that's why we're working, for instance, with shareholders in the different companies, because we believe that they have a very important role to play. If shareholders believe, and if the owners of the companies believe, that it is not acceptable to make a profit at any price at the back of the workers who are actually creating this wealth for the company, then I think we can change this whole model.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, it still comes down to me, the consumer slash worker, actually the worker slash consumer, because at the end of the day, I still need to work to be able to be a consumer.
That's right, exactly. And consumers need to be informed about the conditions under which the goods are being manufactured that they're buying at Walmart, and also about the conditions and in which the workers that are selling those goods are being treated.
Yeah, and which is why the Global Day of Action, why the education process needs to happen. And you know, how do we get involved? How do my listeners get involved in this? You know, what kind of things will we find? Is there a place that they should go on the web, maybe, that will get them a little more information?
Yeah, so we have set up, as the Uni Walmart Global Union Alliance, a Facebook page where we are where all the information about the different actions that are happening around the world are being posted, where we have worker stories there, and where workers and unions from around the world will post information, photos, videos from the different actions that are happening around the world. So if you go to Facebook and you type in Uni Global Walmart Alliance, you will get to that page and you find all the information there.
And we'll make sure we get a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Elka Boseger's name. Last question I've got for you. You know, some people are going to look at what you guys are doing and what, you know, workers across this country have done to this point and say, well, these are people who just want to tear Walmart down. This isn't about tearing them down, is it?
No, it's absolutely not. We believe that it's important that we get them to change their business model, to recognize that they have a responsibility. But Uni's interest is always to build a dialogue with companies so that we take jointly responsibility for the company's success, but also sharing that success with the workers who are creating it.
Yeah, and it's about rewarding those companies who do well and rewarding the people who are moving in the right direction, correct?
That's exactly right. That's the companies that we want to promote, and that's the companies on which we would like Walmart to model their own business.
Absolutely. Elka Boseger, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. We'd love to have you back after the Day of Action at some point.
It was great talking to you. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thanks so much, Elka Boseger. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
One of these days we want to wake up and make a new way. One of these days we're going to
be. The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Our subject this week is our American holiday of Thanksgiving. Miss Sarah Hale had convinced Abraham Lincoln to declare the last Thursday in November as a national legal holiday of Thanksgiving. However, that was short-lived, as Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, declared Thanksgiving Day to be in December. Then Ulysses Grant, who followed Johnson in the White House, appeared to have set a tradition by moving Thanksgiving back to the last Thursday in November. Our presidents kept it that way for 70 years, but that didn't really work either. You see, this was not a federal law, it was a presidential proclamation, and the states were all free to do what they wanted. So southern governors often declared odd celebrations and sometimes no holiday at all. Eventually, the southern states began to join the others in celebrating Thanksgiving on the last Thursday of the month. But join us again next time to see how President Franklin Roosevelt and some lobbyists made yet another wild turn in this long path to a national holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
In this season of the fall harvest, Congress is proving once again that it is a very poor gardener. It keeps watering the weeds and pulling the flowers. A conference committee is presently meeting to hash out a new five-year farm bill, and what a hash they're making of it. For some 40 years, one of the best flowers in the farm bill garden has been the food stamp program, a symbiotic benefit for poor people and farmers alike. Since the crash of 2008, that flower has been especially worthy, keeping millions of knocked-down families from plunging into full-tilt poverty. Yet, with joblessness unabated and poverty increasing, $5 billion was cut from food stamp benefits on November 1st, and the House now wants to yank $4 billion a year more from it, and subject recipients to drug testing and other gratuitous intrusions. Meanwhile, the same gardeners are watering the farm program's noxious weeds. Specifically, they're growing a $14 billion a year crop insurance subsidy that amounts to a guaranteed farm income for the largest, most profitable agribusiness operations. Indeed, while the House wants to force food stamp recipients to prove that their incomes are low enough to qualify for benefits, The crop insurance handout requires no means testing and has no limits on how much recipients can get. This means that billionaires who are only incidental farmers will be among the biggest beneficiaries. And those billionaires are to be given one more little Benny. The farm bill would let them get their subsidies in secret, preventing taxpayers from knowing who gets how much. This is Jim Hightower saying, you should not be punished for being poor, and you shouldn't be subsidized if you're a billionaire. To help plant some seeds of common sense in American farm policy, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's the Environmental Working Group at ewg.org. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Look, we know in days like yesterday and today, we have a lot of work to do. We got to make sure that we work with our counterparties, our clients, to get the answers they want, and we're pursuing that as we speak. And we're also exploring other alternatives, such as strategic investments or investors and other financing alternatives. So we have work to do, and we're doing it right now.
What exactly does that mean?
What exactly does that mean? It's just a bunch of garble. And same thing with all this privatization. And again, I've yet to find anybody who's come up with a scheme that where this has benefited people like me. And maybe Rich has got an idea. I've got Rich online, too. How you doing tonight, Rich?
Hey, pretty good. How you doing, Rich?
Oh, I can't complain. What's on your mind?
Hey, I live in Ohio, and I'm a truck driver. I drive to York, PA every night.
All righty.
And you was talking about the lottery in your first hour.
Yes, sir.
Well, I was wanting to know why we can't propose a national lottery for, like, Medicare, Social Security, and infrastructure.
Why would we want one?
Well, it would pay for itself on the funding.
Well, the problem with the lottery is the exact problem we had here in Pennsylvania. You had the collapse in 2008, and you saw funding go through the floor. So at times when you actually need to make sure that you have secure funding, like during times of economic crisis, you're not going to have it. I see a huge problem with that. And to me, you know, the whole lottery thing depends on folks having disposable income. And that's a problem, especially now that we've seen wages being destroyed and we've seen, you know, the ability of workers to bargain for those wages being diminished. I'm curious, why would you want a lottery system for that?
Because of how these Republicans are, they want to just cut. You know, it affects my mom when they do this.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And what it should be is you and me and other folks like us getting angry at them and throwing the bums out.
Well, I've tried my part, but it's trying to get the people to understand what their policies are.
Yeah, well, and that's why we have programs like this, and which is why we need to be talking to our friends and neighbors. And look, as this stuff comes up, we got to be talking to people.
It's just some of them are so diehard Republican, it kills me.
it blows my mind that, you know, the very people who are the ones being harmed by the policy that they're advocating are the people fighting for the policy it's just the sad reality is it is what it is, but we've got to keep fighting along.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I've taken a pay cut for the last 20 years driving trucks.
No, I know. You know, the sad reality, I drove a truck for years myself, and, you know, I've got my grandfather's contract from 1976 through 74 through 79 here on my desk. And in 1979, a truck driver was making $31 an hour in today's dollars with full health care, eye, dental, and a retirement package, the vacation laid out in this contract, sick days, all of that stuff, and we've allowed this to be stolen from us.
Well, you know, it was Reaganomics that started all this.
Absolutely. But it was beyond that. It was this whole neoliberal agenda, this whole push for deregulation. And it's beyond just Reagan and Republicans. It's a lot of bent-knee corporate Democrats as well. These neoliberals are just as bad.
I agree.
We need to call them out as well and hold them accountable and throw those bums out, too.
Well, I got Bill Johnson. I've called and called his office, and them people won't return my calls back.
Yeah, I've got a crazy representative myself, but I make sure I call and leave email and send messages.
They were calling when right before the elections, and after the elections was over, you didn't hear from them.
Yeah, it's you know, this is where, you know, I think it's so important, especially as a truck driver, to talk to the other drivers. Because I got to be honest, when I was doing organizing, I was amazed at how many right-wing truck drivers there are who think that all of the negative things that are happening to them are the fault of those liberals. Those liberals are doing all this stuff. You know, the people who brought us labor unions?
Well, you get into some nasty fights over the radio.
I've been there myself. Been there myself, Rich.
I just don't understand the people. They want to have Social Security, but yet they want to take these tax breaks. And, you know, I just can't accept taking tax breaks that have benefits.
Yeah, let me ask you about your you mentioned your grandmother a second ago and how this is going to affect her. You know, what do you see happening to her?
No, actually, it's my mother. She's on Social Security now, but they're talking about freezing the
changing the COLA.
Yeah, the income for every year on the increase.
Yep.
And she's only getting like $651 a month. Now that's just tragic, you know.
That's infuriating, is what it is. And what you've got is they're going to freeze the modest, a couple of dollar increase that she would get every year so that we can give hundreds of thousands, if not millions, to the very top of the very wealthy people in this country who don't need it and aren't going to use it to create jobs. To me, that's something to be just absolutely furious about and take to the streets.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'd rather see us go over the cliff myself.
And I'm hoping the president holds firm on this. Because I think the Republicans lose on that. They created this mirage. They created this crisis, this hostage situation. And just as easily as they created it, they can undo it. So any pain and suffering that happens is because the Republicans in this country want it to happen.
Yeah, it's just like I shake my head that, you know, I'm from Ohio and Boehner has nobody running against you.
Yeah, well, that's in Pennsylvania, too. There are a lot of the representatives because they've drawn these districts that are so badly gerrymandered and so manipulated that nobody really has a chance. I mean, where I live, it's a 60-40 district. A Democrat, the savior himself could come down here and not get elected in that district because what we've done in politics is it's team sport. My team's going to win. Instead of talking about the policies that are going to help your mother and my grandmother and help us as working people, they don't want to do that. It's wave the flag for the team. That's what we want to talk about. But again, you know, it's the wealth class who's put us in this position, and we need to break down those barriers.
See, that's like he was talking about Walmart, and they put a distribution center in my county.
Right.
My county gave them a 10-year freeze on no taxes,
yeah,
which was ridiculous. I voted against it, but the majority wanted them to put the business there to get the economy going.
Yeah, well, I mean, we just gave $1.7 billion to a cracker plant that they were going to build in that location anywhere because, hey, the gas is here. They weren't going anywhere else. I got to take a break right here, Rich. I appreciate the call. Next time you're in town, look us up.
I'm here every night, so I listen to your show every day.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Great talking with you.
Bud.
Take a quick break, right back with Hour 3. Of course, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast or Stitcher on your smartphone. Back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Some Whole Foods workers in Chicago are staging a one-day strike today to demand a fair system of scheduling that will allow them to enjoy Thanksgiving like millions of other Americans. They're being joined by the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, Our Walmart, and other community allies. Whole Foods worker Matthew Camp says that retail workers are facing what he says is a disturbing trend of having to work through Thanksgiving and other holidays that used to be sacred time off to spend with family. Camp says this is why Whole Foods workers in Chicago are striking today.
The day before Thanksgiving, which of course is an incredibly busy day for a grocery store, essentially to make these two points. One, that this tendency among large retailers is very disturbing, you know, that we feel everyone's entitled to this holiday. And secondly, that we include ourselves in that first proposal, that we also, having worked so hard for the holiday, are entitled for time to travel, to see our friends, to see our families.
This strike for better schedules and holidays off is within the context of a larger struggle at Whole Foods.
we're organizing with the Workers' Organizing Committee in the Fight for 15 campaign for better working conditions, a better attendance policy. We don't have sick days at Whole Foods, and for better wages as well. That being said, this particular action, the day before Thanksgiving, is really something of our own design. We were inspired, as Whole Foods workers, we were inspired by the Our Walmart Black Friday strikes that have been going on for the past couple of years.
Supporters of comprehensive immigration reform are working to intensify political pressure on Republican U.S. House Speaker John Boehner to act on immigration reform. Since November 12th, SEIU's Alicio Medina, Dreamer and Mi Familia Vota's Christian Avia, and Dae Jung Yoon have been fasting in a Fast for Families tent on Washington's National Mall. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez has been fasting for 40 days. They vow to continue their fast until they can no longer physically sustain it. A major new nationwide effort by civil rights, faith, and immigration reform groups is being launched to continue to push for comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship. Pope Francis on Tuesday said capitalism is a new tyranny. He called on world leaders to act to address poverty and growing inequality. In an 84-page document, the Pope said some people continue to defend trickle-down theories that assume free market economic growth will bring greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. Pope Francis said that's never been confirmed by the facts, and meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. He said under this capitalist tyranny, the powerful feed on the powerless. Thanks to hundreds of listeners and some labor unions who responded to our emergency funding appeal, Workers Independent News is still here in Madison, Wisconsin, putting workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To make sure we stay here, become a solidarity sustainer by donating now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I got no freedom.
Yeah, I can't get this public policy poll out of my head. 49% of voters, Republican voters, 49% of the GOP voters say that they still say that it was Acorn who stole the election. Now think about this. I mean, you know, the 2008 election, 52% of Republicans said that Acorn stole the election, even though Acorn has been, well, defunct for what? 6 years now? Gone? Done? It just boggles the mind. And the other part of it just blows my mind. The 8% of the people who support the Leon Panetta, Conrad Burns plan. You know, the 8% of those people, let's go with Panetta. And on the other side, the 17% of those who, are in opposition of the Panetta Burns plan. Blows the mind. Let's go to D.C. where I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, where do you stand on the Panetta Burns plan to solve the fiscal mirage?
Well, you know something,
there is no plan. There's no plan.
Right. I mean, all of these plans or non-plans are very skimpy on the details. Today, the two former Treasury secretaries who were Treasury secretaries under President Clinton, Rubin and Summers, came out with a plan. But even their plan, which I like better than some of the other plans, needs to be fleshed out a bit.
Yeah. Well, I got to be honest. Anything that Summers and Rubin come forth with, I've got a question.
You know, I do too, but it's better than what's out there.
Well, it's better than the Boehner, the Romney-Ryan plan. It's better than what the Republicans offered yesterday. And if you looked at it, you know, you go, well, where's this revenue? Where's this $800 billion? And, you know, like I said yesterday, the North Koreans found the mythical unicorn. Well, evidently the Republicans found the revenue fairy, because they're not saying where this $800 billion in quote-unquote new revenue is coming from.
Well, yes, and that's the issue, that no one will say where the new revenue is coming from. And just like, you know, they're now touting, although they didn't tout it initially, the Bowles-Simpson plan, but as Senator Sanders has said, and he's speaking at the press club tomorrow, this Bowles-Simpson commission is ruinous, is that a word, for most older people, most people on disability, and particularly even veterans who they estimate, you know, by the time they're in 65 would lose about $2,000 a year, which is a lot for a veteran.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the thing that bothers me, and you know, and I've said this before, I understand shared sacrifice. I understand rolling up your sleeves and getting to work, but not the first club out of the bag. I mean, the first club out of the bag should not be going to my grandmother who's living on a fixed income and saying, hey, by the way, you know, we're gonna change how the cost of living adjustments are made, and you're not going to have enough. And over time, you're going to slide into poverty. And oh, by the way, you're close to retirement age. We're going to push that off a little bit longer so that maybe you'd never make it to Medicare and you never make it to Social Security. Kind of like Simpson.
You know, my problem with this pushing it to 69 years old is, what about people? Well, one, who are in physically demanding jobs, but two, how many people do you know over 50 who lose their jobs because they want younger people or people who aren't going to cost them as much money?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other part of this is, if you're keeping people in the workforce longer, that means you're not opening opportunities for the next generation to come through, and you're not getting that kind of turnover. And to me, that's important. And, you know, as a society, I wish we would change our way of thinking, because I talk to people every day who think that the reason we're on this planet is to work. And me, I think the reason that you work is, well, to live, to enjoy your family and to enjoy, you know, what you can.
Well, you know, in Europe, they say Americans live to work and they work to live.
That's the better way of putting it. But at the end of the day, this pushing off of Social Security and recalculating, or pushing off of Medicare and recalculating Social Security as a first step is the wrong step, in my opinion. We should, at the minimum, be going back to the Clinton tax code. And I would even argue going back to the tax code that Reagan, came into office under, or maybe Kennedy, or even that good socialist president, Dwight David Eisenhower.
Yeah, you know something, I've been reading, this is off the topic, but a new biography, or it isn't so new, a couple of years ago, on Dwight Eisenhower. He was quite amazing.
Yeah.
Well, and he was a Republican.
Well, he not today. Oh, God. He'd be a flaming, he'd be sitting next to Sanders on that far left part of the political spectrum today.
And even Tricky Dick Nixon came up with the EPA.
Yeah, well, and OSHA, don't forget that.
Right.
The job-killing OSHA. But again, these are different times, and I think it's because we're different people. We've been sold and we've been inundated with right-wing corporate blather. We've been brainwashed to believe that anything that the Mitt Romneys of the world and the wealth class want is what's best for us, because, well, they're wealthy, so obviously they know more than we do, and they know how to they're the job creators, right, Ellen?
Right.
But it never seems to work out. I mean, you keep paying to the chair, you keep paying to the chair. I mean, corporate profits have never been better. This third quarter was the highest corporate earnings quarter in the history of this country, since they've been keeping statistics. And you know what is at the other end of that? Wages. Wages have never been lower as a percentage.
And as you know, I don't need to tell you this, the percentage of what a CEO makes. When we were growing up, well, you're younger than me, but when I was growing up, nobody who was a CEO earned more than 7 or 8 times their lowest paid worker. Well, that's, it's thousands of times sometimes now.
You know, when I'm in the process of writing this book, and one of the stories that I'm putting in this book is a story that my grandfather told me, kind of to highlight this, because, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, we were talking about, you know, the split and how the gulf was happening between the very wealthy and the working class. And he told me the story of how he took my grandmother to see a play. She'd always wanted to go to Hannah to see the plays downtown, wanted to go to a fancy restaurant. So he saved up a little bit of money and he did it. They went to this restaurant, made reservations. And as he was being seated, his boss came in. And of course they had to wait because didn't have reservations. And then took my grandma, they had a wonderful dinner, went over to the play and sat down. There were two empty seats next to them. And as fate would have it, as the play began, the lights went down, in comes his boss and his wife, much to the chagrin of the people sitting in the row. And he said it was at that moment that I realized that, you know, now we've got the ability to kind of be in the same world. We live in the same area, but they don't want us around. They don't want the people who do the work around them. They don't want them in their restaurants or in their playhouse.
Wow, that's quite a story.
I mean, it's just an amazing, one of those moments where you go, this is exactly what's happening. Look where we are. And that was only 30 years ago.
Interesting. That is very interesting.
But, you know, it highlights that fact, you know, because what the right keeps telling us, well, you could go to the same restaurants. They don't want us around. We've got gated communities. You've got private clubs that, and some of the fees to get into those. Working people are never going to get there. And we have, as John Edwards, for all his faults, as he said, and he was right about, there are two Americas. There's the America that the ultra wealthy in this country can afford and seclude themselves into, and then what the rest of us have to fight over.
Well, that's right. And if this Republican budget gets its way, it's not going to be hopeful for anybody. And I mean, you wonder, did these people get elected by their local people? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, you look at the gerrymandering that went on into this state, and it happened across the country. I mean, a lot of the states that have Republican legislatures and Republican governors, what you saw were, you know, some magical map drawing, some creative mapping, if you will. Here in Pennsylvania, anyway, they did a masterful job. And the guy who's the head of the Senate here, Pileggi, he wants to go and change the way we allocate electors so that Romney would have won Pennsylvania.
Oh my gosh!
Well, because he wants to go by congressional district, so they wanted it would have been, you know, 13 or 12 votes for Romney and 8 votes or 5 votes for Obama.
So they don't want to do it based on population. They want to do it based on just these areas.
Well, they're going to do it on congressional districts because, you know, in Pennsylvania, while Democrats carried the vast majority of votes and won huge numbers in all statewide races and in the presidential, they did lose. Democrats lost 13 of the 18 congressional seats.
So they want to say, well, if I see what you're saying. Oh, my gosh. That's crazy. Is he going to succeed?
Well, no. I mean, that's not just Pennsylvania. That's the movement across the country. That's going to be the next – that's the 2016 plan to steal the election, because understand, if you were to do that in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in some of the other battleground states, Romney wins. By the way that we've allowed redistricting to happen and the way they've drawn these maps in such a creative fashion, instead of talking about, like Iowa does, how can we get competitive races, how can we get the most Republican wins and put those Democrats across each other? Look at California. Look at here in Pennsylvania. Look at some of the stuff that's gone on. I fear 2016 is going to be that. That's going to be the game plan.
Wow. What can I say? It's pretty astounding. And you're right. The thing is that local people have got to get active.
But it comes down to what we're doing right here. People got to know what's happening. You know, they've got to know what's coming. And I'm telling people, watch what's next. I mean, this austerity I've been talking about for 6-7 years now. Europe's been going through this push for the last several years. We up until about a year and a half ago, nobody in the U.S. knew what austerity was. And now we're looking it right in the face, and they're saying, oh, but it's good for us. It's going to save the economy. We're going to pay the debt off. Nonsense. We're going to hand more money to the very wealthy, and they're going to use it against us.
Well, and the point is that there are the ones that are saying, oh, well, you know, we're not going to even pay health insurance anymore.
Yeah.
In our companies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I also see happening, and I can just hear it in the tone of Washington.
Well, we will see where this goes. I understand Bob Dole was in the Senate today, looking fairly very frail and in a wheelchair. Why was he in the Senate?
Well, he was in the Senate because the United Nations has an international disabilities treaty, and they're trying to get it ratified in as many countries as they possibly can. Well, the disabilities treaty is modeled after and pretty much very similar to the United States Disabilities Act. And so it was our essential wording modeled on us, and your friend, Pennsylvanian, I'm saying that tongue-in-cheek,
uh-oh,
Rick Santorum went there with another Congress senator and lobbied against it, saying it would promote abortion. I mean, just crazy stuff.
Well, I mean, look.
Bob Dole was on the right side of this, as was John McCain.
Well, I mean, Rick Santorum, that's perfect for him because he's got a job at, what is it, World Net Daily, the conspiracy site. So here you go. There's his conspiracy angle. Everything is going to lead to more abortions. I guess that's the writing we're going to see in the future.
I was speechless when I realized what was going on. And there's, you know, frail Bob Dole, who is trying, I mean, he was majority leader. He doesn't even have any sway.
Yeah.
He was a presidential candidate.
You know what the sad thing is, you know, I miss the days of Bob Dole. I miss the days of Richard Nixon. I mean, you know, when the Republicans were at least semi-lucid and semi-rational.
Right, and we thought they were the bad guys.
Yeah.
If we only knew.
Yeah, I mean, this march to the extreme. I'm hoping at some point, I ask my Republican friends, please, a little sanity in your party. Get back involved. Go do something.
And they say their party's too crazy for them to be involved in.
And finally, the governors took to the White House. What did they have to say?
Well, there were three and three. It was a bipartisan group, including Governor Walker of Wisconsin, who, as you know, survived that recall, sort of.
Yeah.
You were there. I wasn't. They basically said they want some control on a state level if they're going to give cuts to the budget and of aid to the state, so that the governors have some control over the way this money is spent, and it is not totally controlled by Washington. Well, that makes sense, and that was bipartisan. Other than that, they didn't say a whole lot.
Yeah, and I understand Governor Cuomo was on the Hill yesterday asking
for
aid.
He certainly was. He was asking for $80 billion with a B dollars. And I think he wanted 42 of that for New York State. He was sort of doing everybody's bidding. He met with both Republicans and Democrats. Doubtful they're going to see that money, but
yeah.
Worth a college try.
Yeah, you got to give it a shot. That's why they pay your salary. Ellen, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Our good friend Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I'll announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat, it is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m., I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
Our subject this week is our American holiday of Thanksgiving. Miss Sarah Hale had convinced Abraham Lincoln to declare the last Thursday in November as a national legal holiday of Thanksgiving. However, that was short-lived, as Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, declared Thanksgiving Day to be in December. Then Ulysses Grant, who followed Johnson in the White House, appeared to have set a tradition by moving Thanksgiving back to the last Thursday in November. Our presidents kept it that way for 70 years, but that didn't really work either. You see, this was not a federal law, it was a presidential proclamation, and the states were all free to do what they wanted. So southern governors often declared odd celebrations and sometimes no holiday at all. Eventually, the southern states began to join the others in celebrating Thanksgiving on the last Thursday of the month. But join us again next time to see how President Franklin Roosevelt and some lobbyists made yet another wild turn in this long path to a national holiday. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
In this season of the fall harvest, Congress is proving once again that it is a very poor gardener. It keeps watering the weeds and pulling the flowers. A conference committee is presently meeting to hash out a new five-year farm bill, and what a hash they're making of it. For some 40 years, one of the best flowers in the farm bill garden has been the food stamp program. A symbiotic benefit for poor people and farmers alike. Since the crash of 2008, that flower has been especially worthy, keeping millions of knocked-down families from plunging into full-tilt poverty. Yet, with joblessness unabated and poverty increasing, $5 billion was cut from food stamp benefits on November 1st, and the House now wants to yank $4 billion a year more from it, and subject recipients to drug testing and other gratuitous intrusions. Meanwhile, the same gardeners are watering the farm program's noxious weeds. Specifically, they're growing a $14 billion a year crop insurance subsidy that amounts to a guaranteed farm income for the largest, most profitable agribusiness operations. Indeed, while the House wants to force food stamp recipients to prove that their incomes are low enough to qualify for benefits, the crop insurance handout requires no means testing and has no limits on how much recipients can get. This means that billionaires who are only incidental farmers will be among the biggest beneficiaries. And those billionaires are to be given one more little Benny, the Farm Bill would let them get their subsidies in secret, preventing taxpayers from knowing who gets how much. This is Jim Hightower saying, you should not be punished for being poor, and you shouldn't be subsidized if you're a billionaire. To help plant some seeds of common sense in American farm policy, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's the Environmental Working Group at EWG.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. It is the holiday season, after all, and what we've seen is Freddie and Fannie have decided that anyone in the eviction process, well, we're going to hold off. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac said they will not proceed with foreclosure evictions during the holiday season, starting on December 17th and December 19th, and extending through January 2nd. Nobody's going to be kicked out of their homes who are facing evicted. Nothing. Now, on the 3rd, you better watch out because we're coming for you. But during the holiday season, we're going to make sure that they don't do it. In fact, Bank of America announced that they will also halt foreclosures just during the holiday season. Trust me, though, they will be back because they don't want to look like the Grinch, because there's a war on Christmas? If you watch Fox News, all you see is, well, the war on Christmas! Those evil people, they don't like religion! And the real war on Christmas, if you really need to know, is not this feigned outrage over people wanting to put up a happy solstice day or Hanukkah symbols or who knows what. It's really global warming. You look at the climate change that's going on, and right now we are in at least a good portion of the country. Right now, 63% of the continental U.S. is experiencing drought conditions. The drought will last probably through the rest of the winter, especially in the Midwest. And, you know, you want to talk about the Grinch, you want to talk about the war on Christmas. Well, the drought has hurt the new growth. These newly planted trees, which take 6 to 12 years to reach full height. So maybe we'll just have miniature Christmas trees from now on. In fact, the Minnesota Star Tribune writes, the dry late summer and fall killed many young trees, perhaps 40%. So, you know, the trees that we get this year, don't worry about. Those are usually 6, 10, 12 years old. Wait a couple of years when there are none, and we have to then pay double. And the reality is, a study after study has shown that we're gonna see more of these severe droughts. We're gonna see more of them more often. And the reality is, it's the climate change. And while we may be seeing the worst drought in 50 years, the impact just isn't Christmas. Just isn't the Christmas trees. We've got food banks who are struggling because, well, there's not as much coming in. Donations down. So when the conservatives tell you, well, it's the war on Christmas, well, we know the real Grinch. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com. That's where you get the podcast, Stitcher. Email rick@ricksmithshow.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@ricksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at ricksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprise.